Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
I feel bad for kicking your seat on purpose.
I'm sorry for mansplaining. That's when a man...
I know what it is.
We should have just told you it's a boy.
I wish you didn't have to hear all that.
Sorry I called you Karen.
That's my name.
Sorry your name is Karen.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, yesterday's Super Bowl marked a lot of firsts. Of course, it was the first to be played in a global pandemic. It was also the first Super Bowl to feature a female referee, Sarah Thomas, and the first Super Bowl to include poetry. The poet who electrified President Biden's inauguration, Amanda Gorman, read her poem Chorus of the Captains during the pregame.
Let us walk with these warriors, charge on with these champions, and carry forth the call of our captains. We celebrate them by acting with courage and compassion, by doing what is right and just. For while we honor them today, it is they who every day honor us.
Well, Gorman is black, as are a lot of the performers during the pregame and halftime show, and of course, many of the players. But the NFL's record on racial equality has been lacking. Until recently, the league did not allow players to silently protest police brutality. They couldn't kneel during the anthem. So it was conspicuous that there were a lot of racial justice messages at the Super Bowl this year. Players sporting the names of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd on their helmets in NFL spots. One spot pledged $250 million to help end systemic racism. Here to talk about all this is Jay Connor. He's staff writer at The Root and co-host of the Extraordinary Negroes podcast. Welcome back to Press Play, Jay.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back. Do you always watch the Super Bowl? Is it something you look forward to?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely something that I usually take part in. Although I think this year the stakes were a little bit different just because for a few years I actually boycotted the NFL in light of, you know, the Colin Kaepernick situation. But I think this year specifically, coming off the heels of, you know, George Floyd and the racial reckoning that our country undertook, you know, the NFL made some steps to try to address the situation. And I think it was a little bit more interesting this year in regards to how they went about it.
Right. And so you had people like the veteran sportscaster James Brown saying this during the pregame coverage.
To do the right thing is to recognize that people are given gifts and talents wrapped in a wide array of packaging, light colored and dark colored, male and female, everyone. If that truth is embraced and acted upon, then fairness, justice, and equality of opportunity will be the byproducts. And most of all, divisiveness does not have to continue. If we choose, unconditional love for people really matters. Because love never, ever fails.
Okay, so that came after CBS aired a video narrated by Viola Davis about the NFL's history with the players of color. What do you make of all this,
yeah.
This very overt display of attempts at racial reckoning and racial healing?
I think that, you know, I think there's definitely a certain level of pandering going on. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I mean, throughout the course of the season, we saw the NFL play, the Black National Anthem. They were putting messaging on helmets. They were putting stencils on the field with Black Lives Matter. And then I believe it was in June that the NFL announced that it was spending $250 million over the course of the next 10 years to combat systemic racism and social injustice. But it's also curious that, you know, the league is taking these steps only after the death of George Floyd and in light of what already happened with Colin Kaepernick. So it's like, how can you treat Kaepernick in the way that you did, but also say that, like, he inspired change and he inspired these whole campaigns? Like, it doesn't make sense. And it's also important to note that, you know, Roger Goodell came forward and said, you know, Black Lives Matter, and I wish you would have went about this differently. But the NFL can't, you know, assert that Black Lives Matter while also making donations to, you know, Republican PACs, you know what I'm saying? Especially mm-hmm. when, you know, Republican candidates have notoriously been one of the biggest adversaries of the movement for Black Lives. So it just sounds like they're just trying to have their cake and eat it too. And I mean, there's a lot of things that a lot of people aren't necessarily privy to that are still ongoing. As far as, you know, the discrimination allegations concerning to the league's concussion settlement program. And I mean, we just had a hiring cycle where, you know, two of the last 20 Black, you know, two of the last 20 coaches in the entire NFL are Black. You know what I'm saying? We just literally saw one of the most well-qualified coaches, Eric Bieniemy, not get a job. So, I mean, they still have a lot to do in regards to addressing these situations. And it's not lost to a lot of us at all.
Okay, let's talk about the national anthem. So R&B singer Jasmine Sullivan sang alongside country musician Eric Church, and here's a little bit of that. Jay, what did you make of that? Another obvious attempt to, you know, portray unity, portray Black-white coming togetherness.
Well, first and foremost, Jasmine Sullivan can do no wrong. She is one of the greatest voices of our generation, and her voice is probably the cure for COVID-19. But as far as the, you know, the racial reconciliation national anthem thing that they had going on, it didn't sit well with me, particularly because of the ongoing controversy surrounding Morgan Wallen in regards to him being found on tape, or, you know, being the footage of it coming out of him, you know, spewing the N-word. And to me, it's just interesting that they specifically sought out an R&B artist and a country artist to kind of do this. And the timing is just horrible.
Although it is one guy, and Eric Church isn't accused of doing that, the guy who was singing with.
No.
Sullivan.
But that's the first thing that came to mind when I saw that.
So you thought it was awkward and weird?
Yeah, I just thought the timing of it, just with that literally happening earlier this week, and that's not to say that mm-hmm. they didn't already have this set up months in advance. It's just the timing was just terrible.
Okay, what about the halftime performance, The Weeknd? What'd you think?
I think The Weeknd, I don't think he was necessarily a good selection for this, as evidenced by my own opinion and that of, you know, the rest of social media. But I mean, I think that, like, visually it was cool. It was cool to look at. But the performance itself, if you got rid of the lights and all the dancing and everything, like, the performance itself, to me, it left a lot to be desired. It felt like he was pretending to be lost in a plastic surgeon's office. Like, I didn't quite understand, like, what he was trying to do.
I literally got dizzy in that Hall of Mirrors situation.
You know, but also I think, too, that he's exactly what they were looking for. You know what I mean? In regards to finding somebody who's going to be a safe pick, who's not going to be, you know, too risque or not going to be too political. Somebody who's just going to be to go out there, perform, and just so happens to be Black while, you know, the NFL is on his kick. So, I mean, he checked every box, but unfortunately he left the last one unchecked as far as, you know, providing a good performance. And you couldn't hear him.
Wow. Jay, you are harsh. You are taking no prisoners today.
Could you hear him when he was performing?
No, not really.
Yeah. See that too.
Yeah. I wasn't into it, I have to say. But he's no J-Lo. He's no Beyonce.
You're right.
Well, maybe next year.
I was about to say, there's always next year. So we'll see what happens next year.
Okay. Jay Connor, writer at The Root and co-host of the Extraordinary Negroes podcast. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you for having me.
A terrible thing to waste. Environmental racism and its assault on the American mind. Written by Harriet A. Washington.
Maybe in your mind's eye, sea level rise looks like waves rolling ashore. What you may not imagine is the sea pushing water up from the ground beneath your feet. And in some places, that can bring toxic contamination. From member station KQED, Laura Clivens has the story.
More than a century ago, industry in East Oakland, California was booming. Lumberyards, canneries, rail depots, foundries.
There are furnaces in which metal is heated, and under the masterful guidance of men, beaten into the thousand and one things needed.
And workers lived nearby. Today, lots of people still live in East Oakland. Marquita Price stands on the porch of the one-story lavender house her grandma's owned for decades.
What you tell me, though, when I would come down here?
Stop jumping over that fence before you break your neck.
So when Price discovered that sea level rise from climate change could wreak slow-mo havoc on parts of this neighborhood, she worried.
How is that going to affect my family, yes, and my community, and the assets that we work so hard to hold, and, of course, our health?
Price is an urban planner and learned about the threat while working on a project with Associate Professor Christina Hill of UC Berkeley.
It's something that people haven't really thought of as an impact of sea level rise.
If you dig into the ground within a mile of the coast here, you'd first hit a layer of fresh water from rain. Below that, you'd find a layer of salt water. The two layers mostly don't mix. That's because fresh water is lighter than salt water and stays on top.
So it sits in the soil, and as the salt water rises, that layer of fresh water will rise also.
That rising water can bring up substances that have lingered for years underground.
Everything we've used in the last 150 years has at some point spilled.
There's also contamination from leaks, benzene and toluene from underground storage tanks, for example. Many toxic sites are now considered to be contained, but not necessarily from underneath.
So legacy contamination in the soil will be remobilized when the water table comes up and intersects with these areas of contaminated soil.
Alec Noggle leads the Toxics Cleanup Division with California's water regulator. He's just beginning to think about how to protect people from these toxics.
Now it's possible that you have contamination in that water, and you might not see it or smell it. You might not know.
Noggle says that if these contaminants start to move, they could seep up into a basement or crawl space beneath a home, or sneak in through a broken sewage line. Some of these chemicals vaporize, and we can breathe them in.
If you're exposed to these chemicals over a lifetime, they can increase your risk of cancer.
Depending on how fast sea levels rise, Noggle says there's roughly 10 to 15 years before groundwater starts moving contaminants. Noggle and his team have to figure out which sites could pose a risk sooner than others.
There are literally hundreds, perhaps thousands of these cases in our region alone, not to mention statewide.
Starting on solutions soon is key. That could mean inspecting and cleaning up sites that were once considered contained. Residents of East Oakland are no stranger to environmental hazards. They already live near major sources of pollution and have outsized rates of asthma. And now this, says Marquita Price.
Things happen. Well, you know, we can't prevent natural disasters or any kind of disasters or problems from happening.
What she can do, Price says, is help tell her community about the threat of groundwater rise so people can do their best to plan for it. For NPR News, I'm Laura Clivens in San Francisco.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind grows slower.
It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rockin', the chip off the block of your favorite schoolhouse.
The push to reopen schools is growing, even as some parents, teachers, and families are concerned that it's not safe enough yet. President Biden reiterated his goals for doing so over the weekend. Just yesterday, Chicago and San Francisco, both involved in contentious battles, reached tentative agreements to reopen gradually. But even doing that in a limited way is challenging. Amna Nawaz looks at plans being made for a bigger reopening in Baltimore.
Judy, Baltimore City public schools have started to reopen, but it's a fraction of all the students so far. Out of the roughly 80,000 students who attend public schools there, 2,000 kids have returned to in-person learning. Now, the city recently delayed expanded reopening for its youngest students by 2 weeks to March 1st. That will allow more time to address the concerns of teachers and educators. For a look at the challenges around all of this, I'm joined by Dr. Sonia Santelises. She's the CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools. Dr. Santelises, welcome to the NewsHour, and thank you for making the time. We mentioned that delayed reopening now, that means thousands of students will be welcomed back into your schools for the first time in nearly a year, K through second grade by March 1st. You're going to roll in older students after that through April. Based on what you have right now in terms of masking and distancing and space to distance in the school, do you have everything you need to keep teachers and kids safe when they return?
We believe we do, Amna, and I think a lot of that is because, one, we invested early in PPE, in redoing and revamping some of our ventilation systems, getting air purifiers where we could. We've also, as you noted, had about 2,000 students in with teachers, principals, paraprofessionals, aides, and that's since the summer. And so the slow and steady building of those numbers has really given us the experience to look back and say, this is how we could really work to, you know, keep our students and staff safe. And we've only had very minimal in-school transmission, only one case, and that was at a lunch site. So we feel as if we really have put the protocols in place to keep families, to keep students and our staff safe.
What about your teachers? What are you hearing from them? We've heard from a number of other cities where teachers are very reluctant to return to school, saying they won't come back unless they are fully inoculated. Maryland has the same vaccine shortages everyone else does, and we know now based on reporting that most of those Baltimore City teachers won't be fully inoculated before March the 1st. Are some of them reluctant to come back?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's a variety of things. I think first and foremost, as one teacher just said to me very recently, a lot of this is fear of the unknown. And this is a teacher who has been in person since the summer. And one of the things she said is, you know, until you're actually in and you can see what the protocols look like, you're going to be scared because we have not done school as a nation in a pandemic prior to this year. She now feels more comfortable because she's been at it longer. But the other piece is we have to take into account the social emotional needs of a lot of our adults as well as our students. We have staff who've lost numbers of family members. I talked to a teacher just recently who, you know, had to bury her father from COVID, and another who lost anywhere from 10 plus members of her family within this pandemic. And so it really does emphasize the need, one, to be able to reassure our staff that we have the safety measures in place, and we do, and also for staff to be able to hear from their colleagues, not just from the CEO of the system, but also from colleagues that are actually out in the field doing the work. From our experience tends to have a far larger impact than anything I might be able to say or do.
What about reluctance among some families? I mean, for all the push to reopen schools, we know, and the CDC studies have shown, specifically among Black and Latino families, there has been real skepticism about sending their kids back into schools, and understandably so, right? These are communities that have been the hardest hit in the pandemic. What are you seeing in your community, and what are you doing to meet them where their concerns are?
So, yes, we have absolutely seen that with the large numbers of Black and Latino families that we serve, that the historical distrust of institutions, including educational institutions and health institutions, is just compounding some of the hesitancy in some families' return. What we have found is that slow and steady demonstrating that your children are safe, that some of the conditions that were the case prior to the pandemic, we've addressed. So something very simple that a number of teachers, not just in Baltimore, but across the country talk about is, well, for example, things like hand soap, right? We know the CDC recommends, you know, hand washing frequently. Well, one of the things we had to do here in Baltimore City was revamp and centralize how we distribute hand sanitizer and soap to school. So when families started coming in and seeing that, yes, there is hand sanitizer, yes, there is social distancing, yes, there is an air purifier in the classroom, it was an exercise in gaining trust for families. And we know those of us who serve large numbers of community members who just have not had that trusting relationship, this really is a trust-building exercise. And so where we can make sure that parents can speak to the principals, see for themselves, actually talk to their children at the end of the day and get pictures during the day, open houses so that families have the chance to dialogue and know what the protocols are, we're more likely to get that success over time. And that's what we saw this fall, where we started with only 250 families out of 1,000 initial spaces. Within 3 weeks, we had all 1,000 of those spaces filled because word began to spread and families saw that we were delivering on our promise to follow those protocols.
How concerned are you about the long-term impact on these kids' academic careers if you don't reopen soon?
No, it's a great question. And one of the things that we are working on now is what does what we call accelerating learning, learning recovery, actually going to need to look like, even beyond just opening the school buildings. But some of the data that we were seeing that was particularly concerning with regards to student learning loss, for example, was our ninth grade data. And we know as educators that the research is very clear that ninth grade performance is an intense indicator of the likelihood that a young person will graduate from high school and graduate ready for college or career. We saw an increase of close to 30%, anywhere between 25 and 30% of our ninth graders who had at least one course failure or had a GPA less than 1.0. And that is a real telling sign of concern of the long-term impact for a number of our ninth graders who were just beginning their high school career.
Dr. Sonia Santelisa, CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools, thank you for making the time, and we wish you good luck and safety in the weeks and months ahead. Thanks again.
Much. Thanks for having me.
This other white woman was saying that she has a small dog, and she has to constantly watch him, and he always gets into trouble. And a tell sign that he gives is he gives Chinese eyes. All right, she didn't use the word squint or any other term that shows that you're doing a certain type of thing with your eyes. She said he gets Chinese eyes, or they get Chinese eyes when they are guilty and they know they've done something wrong.
Since the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak, harassment and violence against Asian Americans has grown. The racist language former President Donald Trump used to describe the pandemic's origins in China didn't help. And now there appears to be a growing number of attacks against older Asian Americans. At least one person has died from their injuries. Bettina McElintall wrote about these events for Vice, and she joins us now. Hi there.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me today.
Tell us more about these violent attacks. What's been happening in these last few weeks?
Of course. So the current conversation was kicked off by an incident on January 28th. Bisha Ratanapakdi, an 84-year-old man from Thailand, was taking his routine morning walk in San Francisco when out of nowhere he was violently pushed to the ground by a 19-year-old attacker. As his family described him, Bisha was nearly blind, he was gentle, and he was beloved, and he had two young grandchildren in whose lives he was very present. His family announced he died 2 days later as a result of the injuries from that fall. A few days later, on January 30th, a 91-year-old Asian man in Chinatown in Oakland was forcefully pushed to the ground by an unknown attacker. And across the country, on February 3rd, a 61-year-old Filipino man in Manhattan was slashed across the face by a stranger on the subway. He told a local news site that he was scared because he thought he was going to die, and nobody on the train helped him. What these have made clear to the Asian American community is not only that we are being targeted, but specifically that the senior citizens in our community are being targeted and face the threat of violent racism.
So these events have happened in the Bay Area, in New York, in a variety of places. How are cities and city leaders responding?
So city leaders have been responding, especially in San Francisco, by denouncing these attacks. Especially because Lunar New Year is coming up this weekend, there have been recent reports that they're increasing police presence in the areas to survey the areas in light of these attacks.
I know that within Asian American communities, there's been a lot of anger and fear. Tell me about what specifically activists and organizations are calling for right now. What do they want to see happen?
First and foremost, activists and community members are asking for attention to these issues. I think it has been clear to us that there has been a rising tide of anti-Asian sentiment, and this has been something that the Asian American community has been dealing with since the start of the pandemic. Many of these incidents have been reported locally, but not necessarily reported in a great extent in national publications. So I think a lot of people are asking for a national spotlight and asking for allies to come out and publicly denounce this racism and this violence that we're experiencing.
Violent crime has grown over the last year in many big cities. What makes officials conclude that these are targeted hate crimes rather than part of that broader wave?
Absolutely. So In March of 2020, the Stop AIPI Hate Reporting Center was established in response to this growing xenophobia and anti-Chinese sentiment that came with the COVID-19 pandemic. Just within March and June 2020 alone, they recorded over 2,100 hate incidents against Asian Americans. Those ranged from verbal altercations in public and, luckily, in smaller part, those that has involved some physical attacks as well. As the Ratanapakdi family wrote in their GoFundMe, this isn't the first time that they've experienced, you know, anti-Asian racism over the course of the pandemic, but it is unfortunately the first time that it has turned deadly for them. So the fear is that in our community is that we are at threat as a whole, but it is especially scary to be concerned that the most vulnerable members of our community, senior citizens, our families, and our elders, are at risk of these violent threats out of nowhere. All of these have happened completely unprompted, it seems, by people who were just walking around in public or taking the subway. None of them have been doing anything out of the ordinary, just doing routine daily life.
I mentioned the way that former President Trump contributed to anti-Chinese rhetoric by using phrases like the Wuhan virus. President Biden has directed federal agencies to combat racism against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders specifically. Do you think that's likely to make a difference?
I think that at the very least, it is helpful to have a public denouncement from the president of this anti-Asian racism. I'm not sure personally that it does anything specifically. However, I think it is very important to have a president who is not actively fueling the fire on this Chinese virus, Wuhan virus rhetoric, which has no doubt caused a lot of people who are racist against Asian Americans to associate the ill effects of the pandemic with Asian people in the United States in general.
That's Bettina McElintall, staff writer at Vice. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for your time.
Now, everybody's like, jails ain't tough enough. Jails ain't tough enough. We got to have a death penalty. Jails ain't tough enough.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. A victory for prison reformers in Alabama. A major bank in the state has cut ties with private prison operator CoreCivic, which has been tapped to build two new men's correctional facilities. This divestment from Regions Bank comes in direct response to pressure from Black Lives Matter Birmingham, and it could undercut the state's plans to build these new prisons. Joining me now to talk more about what's happening are the people who were instrumental in forcing this change. Kara McClure is co-founder of Black Lives Matter Birmingham, and we met her on one of our recent trips to the area. Kara, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Joshua Thompson, an activist with Alabama Students Against Prisons. He's a senior at University of Alabama at Huntsville. Welcome to the show, Joshua.
Hey, how are you doing?
And Lamar Black. He's the co-founder of Faith and Works in Alabama. Lamar, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And this conversation is part of our 1A Across America partnership with WBHM in Birmingham, Alabama. Kara, a spokesman for Regions Bank said, quote, "We are specifically not providing CoreCivic with financing for the construction of prisons to be built in Alabama," end quote. And this is part of the bank's commitment to creating more inclusive prosperity and advancing racial equity. What role did Black Lives Matter Birmingham play in influencing this decision?
Oh, thanks for asking. The role that we played was just connecting the dots and showing the contradiction. I had did some research, looked at their website, and saw that the CEO of Regions had written a letter, a commitment to racial justice and racial equity. And I just picked up the phone and called them and said, hey, we need to have a talk because there's a contradiction between what you're saying on your website and the fact that you're profiting off of prison labor and supplying money for CoreCivic, a company that is known for human rights violations. So that's the role we played, just strategizing with the team that's on the line now and just sharing our story.
Joshua, you were in the meeting with Regions Bank. Just explain a little bit about what happened in that meeting, what argument you made, and how they responded.
We went into the meeting, and they kind of wanted to hear our perspective on our thoughts with their relationship with CoreCivic. And Carl brought up the contradictions between their commitment to fighting racial injustice and while also supporting the building of private prisons and the funding of private prisons. And they asked us a couple of questions along the lines of, like, is the relationship beneficial for the community as far as giving people a foot at the table with companies like CoreCivic? And ultimately, We told them it wasn't beneficial to remain in that relationship because they're still funding the actions of a private prison, which inherently is not a good deed. And there's not really a way to be productive when owning a private prison.
How surprised were you by their response?
I was actually pretty surprised. It was hard to get what their thoughts were during the meeting. They had a pretty good poker face, but I was surprised and pleased that they did decide to end future relationships with CoreCivic and not continue to give them lines of credit. So I was very surprised and very pleased.
Lamar, you're a faith leader. What do you see as the role of the church and faith organizations in ensuring our prison system is humane and just?
I believe that the job of faith leaders all across the state of Alabama and all across the country is to help give those without a voice a voice to stand up and say, hey, this is not right, and we want something to be done about it.
We're talking to Lamar Black, co-founder of Faith and Works in Alabama. Also with us, Joshua Thompson, an activist with Alabama Students Against Prisons, and Cara McClure, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Birmingham. Cara, in hearing how this started for you, it's interesting because it was this very simple thing of going to the website, looking at this bank's core values as they outline them, and then pointing out where you saw the contradiction. How does that make you think about how you may approach this work going forward?
The entire time we were planning this, I was looking at it as that it would be a learning opportunity for organizers and activists here in Birmingham and across the state. And just everything about it, down to sharing the stories. Going into the meeting, we said that we would, you know, talk about how the war on drugs, how we were impacted by the war on drugs. I talked about back in 1993 how I lost my entire community and support system on the war on drugs, and there's still a war on Black people. One of the execs from Region said that they signed the contract with CoreCivic 20 years ago. And I was like, whoa, so you took advantage of a booming opportunity, a trend of Black suffering. And so we are hoping that because of what Regions did, other companies and our elected officials will also take a look. Now we're setting our eyes on BL Harbert, the construction company here in Birmingham that is slated to build the prisons. And we're saying we have billboards going up saying that BL Harbert profits from slave labor. And so it's a real opportunity.
Well, the U.S. Department of Justice is suing Alabama for unsafe and unsanitary conditions. A recent DOJ report detailed prisoner-on-prisoner violence, sexual abuse, excessive force at the hands of prison staff. The prison population in Alabama is around 160% capacity, with roughly 40% of the staffing required. Joshua, how did Alabama get into this situation?
Well, they got put in this situation by over-policing Black communities. Alabama is 25% Black, and the prison population is over 50% Black. So this was by design. This was for profit. They knew they needed more people in the prisons to do basically slave labor in order to create a profit for the state and for these companies and individuals. This is largely because of the war on drugs and the war on Black people in the state that's been going on since forever in Alabama.
Well, Cara, these terrible conditions in Alabama's correctional facilities, are you at all concerned that failing to build new prisons could ultimately hurt the people within those facilities that you're hoping to help?
You know, we've been down this road before in Alabama. Every time there is some type of situation where there's I just believe that there is an infatuation with incarceration. And every time that there is a problem or that they say that there is a problem with overcrowdedness and things of that nature, then the then there's the thing of we need to build new prisons instead of releasing folks that's there on life support, or releasing the elderly, or releasing folks that's there for smaller things. There are so many other things that we can do besides building new prisons. For the amount of money that Kay Ivey is spending on these new prisons, I think now it's $3 billion, I think. But for that same amount of money, we could hire 80,000 more new teachers. With that same amount of money, we could end homelessness in Alabama for 102 years. You know, we can invest in education, not incarceration.
Well, you mentioned Governor Kay Ivey of Alabama, and we should say that this move by Regions Bank hasn't stopped Alabama's plan to build these prisons. The governor signed a 30-year lease for these new prisons last week. Lamar, what are you planning to do next?
Well, our next steps are to inform people of what's going on, the plans that are being made for our lives and for our dollars, and then see where the next pressure point will be. Regions, they committed to ending their relationship. As Cara mentioned, we have another company here that's going to be a Harbor, that's going to be building the third prison. And then we need to find out who else is involved in this goal of private prisons. Where's the money coming from? And then we need to address that.
Cara and Joshua, what do you hope other states take away from what Black Lives Matter Birmingham and the other folks involved with this movement have done with Alabama prisons? And what do you hope they take away from it and maybe try to replicate? Joshua, I'll come to you first.
I hope this leads to states ending contracts with private prisons. Joe Biden recently signed an executive order that federally they will stop contracts with private prisons. They will not renew any. I hope states follow suit with that. I hope it shows that the public and private businesses will no longer support what private prisons do, and I hope other states continue to follow that that trend of ending private prisons and ending mass incarceration.
Cara, what about for you?
Well, my answer would be a little simpler, that I'm hoping that people would see the power of their voice, the power of their activism, and would take action in their state and make noise, because there is power in a small group of people, just organizing and sticking to it until they get a result.
That's Cara McClure, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Birmingham. Also with us, Joshua Thompson, an activist with Alabama Students Against Prisons, and Lamar Black, co-founder of Faith and Works in Alabama. They were instrumental in causing Regions Bank of Alabama to divest from private prison operator CoreCivic, which is being tapped to build two new men's correctional facilities in their state. Thanks to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mama says police misshoot black people.
Is it true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
It's been more than 8 months since the police killing of George Floyd. Next month, the former police officer's charge in his death will go on trial in Minneapolis. Earlier this week, the Marshall Project, in partnership with the New York Times, found new firsthand accounts that former officer Derek Chauvin, who was seen with his knee on Floyd's neck for more than 8 minutes, had acted with that same kind of force before. I spoke with the Marshall Project's Jamiles Larte and Abby Van Sickle, who interviewed several who say they were also victims of Chauvin's use of excessive force. When you look back and talk to other people who have had these interactions with Officer Chauvin, what is the picture that we get?
Yeah, I think the picture that we get is from a number of folks who have had other interactions with law enforcement, the way Derek Chauvin treated them, the way he interacted with them was beyond the pale. It was different. That was something that I heard in every interview, really, that there seemed to just be maybe a heartlessness, a callousness to their pain, to their cries for air or help, or even just the feeling that this is unnecessary, right? This is so over the top.
How many people came forward, and what was it like when you all spoke to them?
Yeah, so we were able to identify six instances where the Attorney General had concluded that Chauvin may have used excessive force. And we were able to find three of those people, and then we were able to find the witness to a fourth incident.
Abby, what was the conversation like with some of these individuals when they're telling you that they also were struggling to breathe under the officer?
So one of the things that surprised us in the reporting is that they had not told their stories before. We were the people explaining that this was the same officer from the George Floyd case. Like, for example, the witness who I interviewed, he said that he had seen this arrest happen. And as he was recalling it, he said, you know, one of the weirdest things is how they just kept this man's head in the puddle. This one officer kept his face down. He was just mentioning it so casually, like it's the thing that's always bothered him, but no one had ever asked him about it. I thought people would have already talked with them and they would know what had happened and their place in this, you know, enormous case.
The stunning thing is not just that you spoke to these individuals that had found themselves in the same situation, but that somehow nothing happened to the officer, that he was still on the force.
When we look at Derek Chauvin's behavior, in real time, there was no official discipline for any of these. Minneapolis does have what's called a coaching program in its police department where officers can be sort of corrected in their approach to use of force rather than reprimand. And those records are not public. So we would not know if Officer Chauvin was coached in any of these instances. But what we do know is that there was no official determination of wrongdoing by the department in any of these. And the majority of them happened after the Minneapolis Police Department had voluntarily worked with the Department of Justice to revamp its accountability measures, including that coaching program. So I think it's a good reminder that departments can be doing, can be making efforts that look productive and look progressive and still have a lot of potentially criminal or potentially acts that are violating people's civil rights or violating use of force principles going unchecked.
So, Abby, one of the stories that you dove into is going to show up in the court proceedings against Officer Chauvin. But you also write that the prosecutor is picking a case where Officer Chauvin did the right thing. Why?
He and the other officers received a commendation for the way that they handled a case. And the prosecutors in their court filings have pointed to wanting to show he knew how to use force. He had been trained in the appropriate use of force, that he knew how to do it. And so that's why it looks like this other case may, you know, be something that the jury hears.
Were either of you surprised when you found these individuals? What was that moment like when they recognized that this could have been them?
None of the folks who we spoke to were sort of surprised that this officer had other instances that we could point to that may have been excessive uses of force. None of them were surprised that there were officers on the Minneapolis Police Department who routinely engaged in excessive use of force and were not punished for those things. None of that was surprising. Yeah. And I'll say, you know, in Zoya Code's case, she remembered Chauvin. She also knew Philando Castile. So I think Zoya's story is really powerful to me because in a sense, it is the connection point between these two fatal incidents, Philando Castile in 2016 and George Floyd in 2020, that, you know, were flashpoints in our national conversation about policing.
Jamiles Larte, Abby Van Sickle, both from the Marshall Project. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This question, why is this stuff happening? The New York Times editorial today. The Trump effect. See, this is what I'm doing with my money, buying newspapers like Dick Gregory. The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 12/10/2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
Investigators are still trying to answer some key questions about the January 6th assault on the Capitol, like exactly who stormed the building that day and what motivated them to be there. An NPR team has been analyzing the more than 200 cases the Justice Department has brought so far. The defendants include military men, extremists, and hardcore Trump supporters. One thing they had in common, they were nearly all men. As Dina Temple-Raston of NPR's investigations team explains, experts say gender likely played an outsized role in the way the day played out.
When we look at the video of what happened that day, it's easy to focus on the violence. The smashing of windows, the tear gas, the five people who lost their lives in the chaos. But Michael Kimmel, a distinguished professor emeritus at Stony Brook University, sees something a little different.
A lot of the guys that I watched on January 6th and subsequently in all of the videos that have surfaced, is these guys look familiar to me.
Kimmel wrote a book about angry white men and what drives them to embrace extremism. And he thinks traditional gender roles, the notions of being a man, played a part in the violence at the Capitol.
They grew up believing that if they worked hard, paid their taxes, were good guys, that they would be able to live the lives that their grandfathers lived.
Kimmel said that when that doesn't happen, a kind of aggrieved entitlement takes hold. And that's the kind of dissatisfaction that drew people to former President Trump.
Our country has had enough. We will not take it anymore. And that's what this is all about.
We often see this notion of a band of brothers. We often see people getting drawn into joining extremist groups at moments when they're feeling confused about their identity or they've experienced a status loss.
That's Jessica Stern, a professor at Boston University. She's been studying extremist groups for decades, and she said that people who were there on January 6th were familiar to her, too. Consider Barton Wade Shively, a burly ex-Marine who was charged with striking police officers as he rushed the Capitol that day. He spoke with CNN outside the day of the protest.
Push them back a little bit until finally they started getting rough with us, so we had to push them back. So that's what we did. We pushed them back.
Shively seemed angry.
That's what we're doing. We're fighting back.
And what's the point? What's the end game?
What's the point?
Yeah.
We're losing our freedoms. What do you mean, what's the point?
According to court records, Shively allegedly surrendered to authorities and said he got caught up in the moment. His lawyer did not respond to NPR requests for comment. Shively wasn't alone in thinking that a greater purpose had brought him to the Capitol. Felipe Marquez of Florida saw himself in much the same way.
I went on the 6th in D.C. to protest against communism and prostitution. This is like a Rosa Parks, like Martin Luther King moment for me.
Marquez, according to court documents, is accused of not only storming the Capitol, but also breaking into the office of an Oregon senator. NPR has examined the affidavits in each case related to the Capitol riot so far, and the words of Shively and Marquez were echoed in dozens and dozens of them. Diana Mutz is a professor of political science at University of Pennsylvania, and she's studied Trump supporters. And one of the things that animates them, she said, is the desire to return to a simpler time.
I think it's important to realize that, yes, they're experiencing change and that this is threatening. The advantages that these groups enjoyed aren't there to the same extent.
They have jobs, they have families, but they don't have a sense they're doing really well. To be sure, a group this large defies generalization. There was someone in a Camp Auschwitz t-shirt, and there was a rabbi from Florida. There were far-right militia members and a two-time Olympic gold medalist. Still, an NPR analysis of the records collected on the more than 200 people charged provided some common threads. For example, almost 15% of the people charged so far are either current or former military. About 17% of those charged have an avowed connection to an extremist group. And nearly 11% of the Justice Department's cases included someone who spoke specifically about being inspired to storm the Capitol by former President Trump. That's from a New Yorker video inside the Capitol that captures a sense of the crowd's purpose, that they were there for a bigger reason than themselves. Now, more than a month after the siege, people are starting to ask the next obvious question. Where do we go from here? Mutz says one remedy may be just a return to the kind of politics that doesn't require our full, undivided attention.
The fact is, when we live and breathe politics 24/7, and it's the first thing you see when you turn on the TV and so forth, it elevates the salience of politics in people's lives in a way that may not actually be healthy for the nation as a whole.
In this case, she said, boring may be a good thing. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News.
For a full list of the people who have been charged with storming the Capitol and their stories, go to NPR.org.
You know, First Ladies usually have a cause, and you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
Should websites that host hate speech and conspiracy theories have a home on the internet? There's a tech company outside Seattle that thinks they should, and it's become one of the most controversial players in the debate over the future of online speech. NPR's Bobby Allen traveled to Sammamish, Washington to talk to the man at the center of it.
He lives at the end of a cul-de-sac in this woodsy Seattle suburb and welcomes me to his lakeside home.
Yeah, that sounds good.
The man's name is Rob Monster. Yep, that's his real name.
If you wanted to cast a villain who was going to be the Lex Luthor of the internet, Rob Monster is about as good as it gets.
For years, Monster has run a business called Epic. It buys and sells website names like Diamond.com or 3D.com. There's big money in the world of coveted web domains. In 2018, Monster stopped being a low-key tech executive. That's when the world found out that the shooter charged with killing 11 people at the Pittsburgh synagogue had used a right-leaning social network, Gab. In the fallout, Gab lost all of its web support.
And I looked at that and said, you know what, I don't think there was a lot of due process in terms of how the decision was taken to deplatform Gab.com.
So he reached out to Gab and helped them get back online. Now, sites know if they become too radioactive for support providers, Epic will be standing by with a lifeline. Epic now supports the conspiracy theory website InfoWars, embattled conservative platform Parler, the largely unregulated YouTube alternative BitChute, the gun forum AR15.com, and others.
If somebody wants to go through a messy swamp in their search for truth, who are we to decide that they shouldn't have the opportunity to do that?
But in the messy swamp of sites Epic does business with are conspiracy theories about the election, vaccines, and mass shootings, and a steady stream of bigoted content about Jews, women, and people of color. Monster's libertarian approach concerns researchers who track hate groups online. Michael Edison Hayden is with the Southern Poverty Law Center. He says hate speech permeates all corners of the internet, including major platforms, Facebook and Twitter. But he says the sites Epic is keeping alive are notorious for doing almost nothing about it.
The difference is that there are people with terroristic ambitions plotting out in the open, producing propaganda that they seek to use to kind of encourage violence. And those are the type of websites Rob Monster is willing to pick up.
Monster says he has standards. For instance, Epic dropped the neo-Nazi website The Daily Stormer and severed ties with the hate-spewing image board 8chan. On the sites Epic does support, it's easy to find some pretty ugly and hateful content. But Monster has faith in the sites regulating themselves.
Epic is standing in the gap, trying to find that fruitful compromise that allows people to have the luxury to be able to ask questions, seek answers, while at the same time being a stakeholder in the re-architecting of a better internet where we can have civil conversation.
The sites Epic backs, though, are far from civil. Experts say some have been gathering places for white supremacists and have radicalized people. And the rhetoric has led to real-world violence. Case in point, the storming of the Capitol that was largely documented on sites Monster helps maintain, like Parler. David Kaye is an online speech expert at the University of California, Irvine.
So he can say they're just shock jocks, but what we actually see is real-world harm coming from the platforms. And so how much is, you know, somebody who is allowing that kind of content to be hosted, how much are they operating in real good faith?
And this really is the question. If you believe Monster, he just wants an open internet where the most incendiary and toxic content lives alongside everything else. Big tech playing internet cop, he says, gives companies the levers to control what we see and don't see online. And he argues the crackdown has been overzealous. He points to Facebook and Twitter banning former President Trump.
One thing to be sent to detention. It's another thing to get a suspension. It's another thing to be sent to a penal colony for the rest of your life.
In Monster's vision for the internet, tech companies do not interfere with who can speak or what is said. But experts say when people's lives and democracy are on the line, speech with no regulations is not always a good thing. Bobby Allen, NPR News, Sammamish, Washington.
The Aryan Nations attracted people from all walks of life who were white. All of them looking for someone to blame for the situation. And they focused their anger on the federal government.
Federal prosecutors have charged more than 170 people so far in connection with the Capitol riot. The insurrection has increased pressure on the Biden administration to tackle domestic violent extremism. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas reports.
Gregory Erie is no stranger to domestic terrorism in America. That's because he spent a good chunk of his FBI career investigating it.
The threat of domestic terrorism certainly isn't new. It's something that the country and the Bureau has been dealing with for literally its existence.
In recent years, domestic violent extremists, particularly white supremacists, have caused more deaths than people with links to international terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. Two horrific attacks, one on a Pittsburgh synagogue and the other at an El Paso Walmart, are prime examples of the lethal nature of the homegrown far-right threat. The insurrection at the Capitol, meanwhile, points to the growing scale of the problem.
The last 4.5 years have been incredibly problematic in terms of how big this problem has gotten.
That's Michael Jensen, a terrorism researcher at the University of Maryland. He says the problem stems in part from the torrent of disinformation and conspiracy theories that proliferated on social media and were then amplified by President Trump while he was in office.
We potentially now are dealing with a problem of mass radicalization. So we're not talking about the case of a few people here and there that got themselves caught up in an extremist milieu and radicalized. We're potentially talking about millions of people.
Jensen says there's no easy answer, but he says programs to counter extremism must factor into the equation, because the country can't arrest its way out of the problem. And yet the responsibility to prevent attacks falls in large part to the FBI. Director Christopher Wray said last year the Bureau had put domestic extremists motivated by race or religion on the same threat level as international terrorism. The Bureau says it has adjusted resources to be commensurate with the threat, but observers say more still needs to be shifted to the domestic side of the ledger. One example is the FBI's Domestic Terrorism, or DT, section. It looks into all domestic terrorism investigations and coordinates with the FBI's field offices. Greg Erie led that section from 2013 to 2015. At the time, he says, it had roughly 20 people in it. The international terrorism section, in contrast, had several hundred. Erie, who is now at the Anti-Defamation League, says the FBI should look at more of a balance between the two sections because of the growing threat from domestic extremists.
And that needs to be resourced properly, was focusing the investigators, the analysts, and putting more people on it so they can work again with the field to investigate and mitigate those threats.
He also points to the 200 or so joint terrorism task forces around the country. Over the years, they have primarily focused on jihadist extremist threats. The FBI director has said he's instructed the task forces to keep domestic terrorism, quote, squarely within their sights. But Erie says not all task forces have squads dedicated to domestic terrorism. Some former officials argue that's appropriate since each task force can best assess how to use its resources. But Erie thinks there should be a squad dedicated to domestic terrorism on every task force because it would allow agents and analysts to develop an expertise.
If you did this with DT and we could dedicate those assets to it, you're going to have not only a focus and an identification of the groups that are in that region, but that bureau sharing across the country.
There are unique challenges that arise in investigating domestic terrorism. particularly when trying to prevent attacks before they happen.
It's a little tricky when you're in the domestic terrorism environment, because certainly speech and association are not crimes, and people have a right to do that. But you want to stop violence before it occurs.
Barbara McQuaid oversaw both domestic and international terrorism investigations when she served as the U.S. attorney in Detroit. There has been a long-running debate about creating a new domestic terrorism statute. McQuaid says that might help law enforcement because it would make it easier to open an investigation, to use wiretaps and informants and other tools to infiltrate organizations.
But even with the statutes we have on the books, I think just a more fulsome focus on this threat and taking it seriously at the highest levels of government, devoting resources to it to ensure that we are disrupting acts of violence, I think is an important first step.
The Trump administration largely ignored the issue. But in his first days in office, President Biden instructed the Director of National Intelligence to pull together a comprehensive threat assessment of domestic violent extremism, an indication that the new administration views this as a priority. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
As a political scientist and Latin American scholar, Carlene West has studied strongmen in that region, leaders like Juan Perón, Hugo Chavez, and Alberto Fujimori. She writes, they are people who use populism and charisma to govern with an iron fist. And she puts Donald Trump in that category, too. But this isn't just an academic pursuit for West. It has become personal. Her mother took part in the Save America rally that turned into the storming of the U.S. Capitol 1 month ago. Carlene West, who teaches at the State University of New York at Geneseo, has written about her mother in an opinion piece appearing in Syracuse.com. And she joins us now from Rochester, New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's first establish that your mother was not one of the people who entered the Capitol. She just took part in the rally.
That's right, though she did march to the Capitol as President Trump ordered.
How did you find out about that?
Well, that was a difficult day. I knew that my mom was traveling across the country in the midst of a pandemic to participate in Trump's Save America rally. But I actually wasn't watching the news that day. I was busy teaching a class called Democratization that, ironically, focuses on the challenges and threats to democracy around the world. And so I received a text from my sister saying, "Mom is safe." I just checked in with her, and my heart immediately dropped because I knew that something had gone terribly wrong at Trump's rally.
Tell us about your mom. You write that she was a registered Democrat who supported Ted Kennedy in the 1980 presidential primary.
She was. But like millions of other Americans, my mom really admires Donald Trump. She admires his success, and she identifies with him in a way. You know, Trump doesn't listen to his advisors. Well, neither does my mom. She doesn't take crap from anybody. She was a one-time unpartnered mother who lived on the verge of poverty. And she, I think, identifies with Trump's personality in a way.
Have you two been able to talk about it?
Well, sadly, I have better answers for the political questions than I do for questions about what it means to be a daughter of a Trump supporter. Like so many families in the United States right now, politics has become a forbidden conversation among my family members. And so it's not something that's easily discussed. And I think a lot of people right now can relate to that, that it's a difficult conversation to have with people who you love, but who you disagree with.
What do you want people to understand from telling your story?
I've had so many people reach out already to thank me for writing the article because, to be honest, I felt very lucky that I am a political scientist and that I do have some context for what is happening in the United States right now. And so I really just wanted to share my story to provide other people with that knowledge that what we're seeing in the United States is really drawn from the playbook of dictators and authoritarian leaders all around the world. And I truly believe that the Republican Party needs to own up to the fact that they have been lying to the American people about election fraud, and they need to hold Trump accountable by convicting him in the Senate. Otherwise, we really risk condoning authoritarian behavior by candidates in the future.
But do you think that that will change someone like your mother's mind?
I do believe that all Americans, and especially Trump supporters like my mom, deserve better from the Republican Party. They need to stop acting in their own self-interest and start prioritizing our democracy. Even if it doesn't change my mom's mind, at least it is what our country deserves, this commitment to democracy.
I come from a divided family politically, and that idea of not being able to talk about politics is one that is very familiar to me. But there is a whole cadre of thought that believes that actually we won't be able to heal as a country unless we have the difficult conversations. Have you thought about discussing this with her?
At this point, I feel that passions are so high around what happened at the Capitol that day and around what so many Americans believe is the truth about the fact that the election was stolen from Trump, that those passions make it really difficult, even with someone that you love, to have a conversation about these political events.
That's Carlene West. She is an associate professor of political science, international relations, and Latin American studies at the State University of New York at Geneseo. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
When is a trial not a trial? A question. What happens at the beginning of a trial? The answer's simple. Jury selection. Why? Because jurors decide cases. Therefore, special attention must be paid to whom the jurors will be. Consider, therefore, the so-called impeachment trial. How members of the Senate perform as jurors, or those who actually decide guilt or acquittal. Before the trial formally began, a clever Republican, Senator Rand Paul, Kentucky, threw a monkey wrench into the proceedings by submitting a motion challenging its very constitutionality. The motion drew 45 votes, the vast majority Republican, who voted overwhelmingly that the trial was unconstitutional. Today, the trial is in process. And who knows how it will end? I don't. If I had to guess, I'd say it'll end the same way that the first impeachment trial did, with acquittal. And that's for political reasons. This is, after all, a political process. But I must add, I don't know what will happen. No one does. We shall see. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Accused Kenosha shooter Kyle Rittenhouse remains free on bond tonight. A judge tonight denied prosecutors' request to have the teen arrested and his bail increased. Ben Jordan explains the decision.
The Kenosha County District Attorney's Office wanted the judge to issue a warrant for Kyle Rittenhouse's arrest for failing to share his home address. The judge described it as a minor issue worthy of a slap on the wrist.
Are we just going to turn a blind eye at this?
A battle over where Kyle Rittenhouse actually lives was squashed today in Kenosha County Court. Justice Bruce Schroeder ordered Rittenhouse to disclose his address just to the court, but he declined to punish the Illinois teen for neglecting to share that information.
I've got two broken windows here, right here in this courtroom. So no, I don't want anything that might kindle further violence.
Prosecutors claim Rittenhouse lied at hearings in January about where he lives in an effort to remain off the radar. Prosecutors argued that people out on bond are required to provide their actual address and any changes to it within 48 hours.
We don't know where an accused murderer's at, and I think that's a problem. I'm not okay with that.
But Rittenhouse's attorney says even before the Illinois teen posted his $2 million bond stemming from charges of allegedly killing two protesters and injuring a third, the Rittenhouse family made it clear to prosecutors that they left their Antioch home after receiving death threats.
We have nothing to fear. The truth will set my client free.
Judge Schroeder sided with Rittenhouse's defense on this debate, citing three reasons in particular. The court has already received his substantial bond, Rittenhouse has made every required appearance, and he hasn't been accused of a serious crime while awaiting trial.
There are a very, very, very high percentage of people who are out on bond where the people say, yes, I've got a new address. I've never jailed one of those people.
The decision comes much to the chagrin of Gage Grosskreutz, a man who survived the August shooting, and to the father of Anthony Huber, one of the protesters who died.
How would you feel if the killer of your son is just able to walk free and make videos and bars and live it up?
The court hearing ended today with prosecutors frustrated they too won't be privy to where Kyle Rittenhouse lives. The district attorney's office says that is a first for them in a criminal case, but the judge says having the sheriff's office know is enough. Reporting in Milwaukee, Ben Jordan, TMJ4 News.
First order of business when it comes to the black female. First time, last time. I think I said this before on this program. I've certainly said it on many others. What do I mean by first time, last time? First time he hits you. That's the last time.
For the very first time, the woman who says she was attacked by former Seattle Seahawks player Chad Wheeler is speaking out. Last week, you may recall, Wheeler pleaded not guilty to three charges, including domestic violence assault. His ex-girlfriend showed up in court to face him. She says that Wheeler is still a threat to her safety. And now she's sharing her story in an exclusive interview with CBS This Morning. She spoke with our national correspondent, Jerika Duncan. Good morning to you, Jerika.
Good morning to you, Gail. Her name is Aaliyah Taylor, and it was a leaked photo of her injuries that made national headlines. Well, now she's ready to share her story. And most importantly, she wants domestic violence survivors to know they're not alone. We want to warn you, some of what you're about to see and hear is graphic.
I still have to regularly get, like, my concussion checked. I have bolts and a steel plate I'm going to have forever in my arm. I'm going to have to deal with this the rest of my life.
That's the reality for 27-year-old Aaliyah Taylor after she says she was attacked by her then-boyfriend Chad Wheeler. Taylor says the pair dated for 6 months with barely any arguments.
We were like best friends. We did everything together. I even introduced him to my family. We would babysit my nephew together.
But according to Taylor, that all changed on January 22nd, starting with a text from Wheeler that he'd shaved his head.
He loved his long hair, refused to cut it, and it surprised me and it worried me. I came home and Chad was trying to play it off as if he just kind of cut his hair. But then as time went on throughout the day, he started going downhill emotionally.
Taylor later told police it was the beginning of a manic episode, adding she knew Wheeler suffered from bipolar disorder. Then, according to Taylor, Wheeler snapped into a dark place.
And he stood up and he told me to bow down and I asked him why, and he didn't respond. He just told me to bow down again, and I told him no, and he immediately grabbed my neck, and that's when things began.
Do you recall what happened after that?
When he grabbed my neck, he threw me on the bed, and I remember looking up at him and asking him, please stop, Chad, it's me. And I just immediately knew the look in his eyes. That was it.
Taylor, who is 5'9", says that's when Wheeler, 6'7", weighing more than 300 pounds, tried to choke her. According to Taylor, she blacked out twice before the attack was over.
I had touched my face, and I looked down, and there was blood on my hand. And I remember getting up and running to the bathroom. Chad was standing by the bed, by the doorway, and he was sipping his smoothie. And it's like, wow, you're still alive.
Please help me now. I'm going to die.
Taylor says she then locked herself in the bathroom, called 911, and texted her family and Wheeler's father for help. According to police reports, it took three officers and two sets of handcuffs to restrain Wheeler. Police said Wheeler kept apologizing as he was arrested. Do you think that Chad's behavior is directly connected to a mental health issue?
To be honest, I don't know. He went and ate dinner after doing this to me, and he didn't take the same approach with the cops as he did with me.
The Seahawks dropped Wheeler, saying the team strongly condemns this act of domestic violence. If convicted, Wheeler faces 8 to 12 years in prison. Last week, he pleaded not guilty to two domestic violence-related charges and one count of resisting arrest. Taylor was in the courtroom.
Why was it so important for you to appear in court?
I didn't want him to think that he had that power over me, that I wasn't going to defend myself. And I thought, how easy would that be for him and his legal team to be able to say whatever they want without having to look me in the eye?
Do you think he should serve prison time for what he did to you?
Yes. Yes, I definitely do think that he should. I have to say the hardest part of all this wasn't the surgeries, wasn't any of that. It was getting a call from my niece and nephews. They thought they had lost me. And the pain in their voice, I will never forget that. I will never forget that.
And she doesn't want her story to be forgotten either.
How grateful are you to be alive?
Beyond grateful, I really feel like God has blessed me with another chance. And I want to try to use the time I've been blessed with to help other people and to get this story out and make sure people don't feel alone and that this doesn't happen again.
CBS News reached out to the attorneys for Chad Wheeler. They declined to comment on the case. Wheeler's trial is set to begin in Washington State in April. A reminder, if you need help related to domestic violence or mental health, we've posted free resources on our website, cbsnews.com. A lot of strength exhibited by this young lady.
Yes,
very brave.
So important, so powerful that she's speaking up, and especially the pictures, Derica, are heartbreaking. And you look at the numbers, her height, his height, her weight, his weight.
6'7", 5'9",
A terrifying change in his demeanor.
Yes.
A shift, 6 months of dating, and then suddenly that?
Yeah, and she said not even an argument. You could tell she was very conflicted because she cared so much about him.
Yeah.
But this is one of those difficult stories to tell because it's not just the domestic violence, but also recognizing that there is a mental health component in this.
Yes, it's interesting that she had to say to him at one point, Chad, it's me.
It's me.
Right.
Although, as a matter of mental health awareness, being bipolar does not mean you beat up your family members.
Exactly. It's a very important
something else
point.
Going on here.
All right. Jerika, thank you very much.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Former President Trump has been acquitted. Senate proceedings concluded during the broadcast. We've had a number, 12-year anniversary of the cows. We've had a number of things that happened seemingly while we were live on the air. So President Trump acquitted in the Senate live while we were on the air. We got the verdict in the Trayvon Martin murder trial 2013. That happened while we were live on a compensatory call-in, no less. Michael Jackson's funeral in 2009. We had Noel Ignatieff. It's been quite a few things that were Ferguson. They decided that they were, of course, not going to indict the killer of Michael Brown Jr. We were on live. Many, many things have happened over the year while we have been broadcasting live. But former President Trump, not guilty. Mumia Abu-Jamal was correct. Black History Month continues. Saturday, February 13th, 2021. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Many things happened this past week, even just within the last 24 hours or so since we went live. We will try to share some constructive information, suggestions, counter-racist thought or three. The number is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Long list. Let's see. Number one. It happened twice this week. Reading, more important than watching television. Check out the news locally, nationally, globally. So last week, going into the Super Bowl, we talked about Britt Reed, suspected racist assistant coach for the Kansas City Chiefs, who just lost in the Super Bowl. Mr. Reed, who is not in greater confinement, is allegedly, they're thinking he had some alcoholic beverages. Apparently, he reported to enforcement officials that he had consumed alcohol before getting in his vehicle and then crashing into two separate parked vehicles on the side of the road. He hit both of these vehicles, and there were small children in one of the vehicles, small, like 5, 4 years old. He crashes into the car and leaves the 5-year-old with life-threatening injuries. Apparently, she's still in a coma. It's been a bit more than a week at this point, and, you know, still super dangerous. You know, family's just trying to hope for the best still. And I think the 4-year-old, the 5-year-old is Arielle Young, and then her cousin, the 4-year-old, I think she had like a broken nose and some other injuries, but not critical. I think she's been released from the hospital. But I saw all of this, and I brought it up on Workplace Racism yesterday. In addition to Britt Reed, I think he's had criminal activity before with alcohol and drugs, and he was not fired. He is no longer employed with the Kansas City Chiefs, but it's not like this incident happened. It's like, oh, my God, you almost killed two small children. You're out of here. Super Bowl or not, get out of here, buddy. Give us our, you know, Super Bowl gear back, too. That didn't happen. They just allowed his contract to expire and then not renewed. We talked about that. Like, man, you think anybody, anyone here, you think on your job you could be drinking under the influence, hit two cars and nearly killed two small children? And we'll give you the benefit of the doubt. We'll see how this plays out. Anyway, the additional tragedy of all this, Arielle Young is a non-white female. I did not know that until many days had passed, because I had seen this incident. It was talked about at the Super Bowl and what have you, but I didn't see pictures of this victim until, as I said, days later. So I mean, wow, like the extraordinary tackiness of it. I think I've said for years, for a healthy chunk of the dozen years that we've been broadcasting, I've said the most dangerous combination in the known universe, or certainly one of the most dangerous, is alcohol, whites. Talk about sobriety would be best. Talk about all of the drinking and antics that go on leading up to the Super Bowl. And some folks even talked about that and saying, hey, apparently he might have been leaving the Chiefs, Kansas City Chiefs facility when he had this accident. Was he drinking on the job? They have cameras at these facilities. Did anybody know? And again, apparently this might be someone, Mr. Reed, with a history of alcohol problems, substance abuse issues. Do the Chiefs have some responsibility in all of this? That was one. Follow the pattern. So two, you heard the report about 6'7", 300-plus-pound white man Chad Wheeler talking about domestic terrorism. Seattle Seahawks making Russell Wilson and my home team look bad. I read about this report. I'm in Seattle, man. I'm right here. I see it's in the front page of the Seattle Times every day. So I saw this almost immediately. They didn't have a picture of the victim, which is that's customary, right? If it's domestic violence, anything like that, they don't name the victim. They don't do any identification. That's standard journalism procedure. But they listed this white man, so I read all about it. Boom, boom, boom. Okay. There was nothing that suggested the victim was a non-white person, but I read all about it, and specifically there was a cryptic line. You heard in the report, Aaliyah Taylor, 5'9", you heard this non-white female, black female, you heard her saying that, you know, he went to eat dinner. You know, he nearly kills me and just goes to eat dinner. In the newspaper report in the Seattle Times, it said that he went, after he nearly killed her, he went, Chad Wheeler went to get a smoothie. Black female, Miss Taylor, she regains consciousness. Groggy, walks, you know, to try to get out of there, escape. And he looks and says, oh, my goodness, you're still alive. I said, I read this and I said, this is like something out of if you've seen like some of those like terror movies like Fargo or Pulp Fiction. Where the guy goes and he'll kill, you know, someone and do something gruesome and then go get a bowl of, you know, like Frosted Flakes or, you know, make pancakes and the body is in the back and they're just eating pancakes and watching television. Like something. I mean, just what is going on? No idea was a victim. A couple days pass. I'm talking to a victim of racism off the air. And she says, man, you should include that clip. Well, first it's brought up Chad Wheeler. Did you hear about it? Of course I heard about it. I'm in Seattle. How could I miss it? She says, you should play that for the compensatory call in. And I said, you know, I have to see. I haven't really got all the clips together for what I'm going to play. So I have to see if that's relevant. I don't generally play segments. You know, if it's a white person, a white man brutalizing a white woman. Yeah. I don't know how high of a priority that is. She's like, what? It's a black female. It's like, dude, what? I go and I check the news. I think this was like Wednesday or Thursday. So I saw this report when it happened, as I said, days ago, nearly a week ago. Miss Taylor didn't do that interview until like Wednesday. So some time had passed in context. Some time had passed. So I didn't realize that she had spoken out and that this had, you know, kind of become a national story and everything when she did her news report and everything. Totally stunned. Not that that makes it any better. It does not. But just, wow. I was absolutely stunned. And then for it to be right here. Man, first time, last time you heard that from Neely Fuller Jr. First time, last time. But even beyond that, we have talked about tragic arrangements. They have that title for a reason. I saw that report. I thought of Pam. You heard the audio of Pam at the beginning talking about some of the initial information that she heard from Neely Fuller Jr. and talking about Area 8. I said, have to see if we can get Renethia Tate to come and talk about this incident, because that's one I would share. When people talk about all the swirling and all the interracial romance and the hate you give, scandal, all the rest of it, promoting tragic arrangements. This might be one just to share. Miss Taylor, she said, you know, he was so kind and cheerful and they hung out with her relatives and babysat, you know, her nephew and everything. Never argued. Pleasant, wonderful fella. Until... Incidentally, he is charged with felony domestic assault. I was thinking, why not attempted murder? They said in the report that he tried to choke this 5'9" female, that he tried to choke her. If you have your hands around someone's neck and you're a foot taller than them, and you outweigh them by probably 200 pounds, if not more, and they black out, I'm going to say we can remove the word try. You choked her. I'm thinking this should be attempted murder. Why is this not attempted murder? Maybe we'll get that question answered sometime between now and April. And maybe they'll even upgrade the charges. That would be spectacular. But that's what I was thinking. Like, she is lucky. He said it. He said, I'm surprised you're alive. I can't even believe it. I'm pretty sure I killed you. Tragic arrangements. First time, last time, Neely Fuller Jr. Let's see. I mentioned we are in Seattle. Man, I just said days ago in Seattle, general, I was bragging about the weather. All the people were complaining about all the snowstorms and everything and blah, blah, blah. It's 50 degrees. We never have that. Hasn't even snowed here in Seattle. Almost as soon as I said that, we got a half teaspoon of snow on Wednesday, which was no big deal. You know, it was here. It was one of those. It was so quick. If you fumbled around and took too long to get your camera, it would melt before you could take a picture. That happened again on Thursday. We got another half teaspoon of snow. Yesterday, we did not get the half teaspoon. We got gallons and gallons and gallons, and it has snowed and snowed, and it's continuing to snow. I have not seen this much snow here in, it's been some years, I think. It doesn't really snow like that. And as I said, because it doesn't snow here very often, many folks here do not have a lot of practice driving in snow and or just, I guess, existing in snow, period. So it always causes a lot of mayhem, and it certainly has this time. The roads are terrible. The one thing that I do appreciate about it, it is very quiet. Since all of the roads are snowed over and have been basically since last night, it snowed for 24 hours, which is kind of odd. That doesn't happen here very often at all, but it is very, very quiet, which I appreciate. And I'm also super pleased because I can't say I was checking the weather aggressively. And I was so unprepared, and I'm so unaccustomed to this type of cold weather. And it's in the 20s. It's hardly ever that cold here. Like, man, I'm not feeling that at all. But I'm so unaccustomed. It took me a while for my brain computer, Welsing metaphor, to even process that the weather had changed substantially. It was just 50 degrees the other day. I woke up. I'm sitting around. I'm like, wow. It's kind of cold. The heat clicked on, and it normally just clicks on a little bit because it's 50 degrees. So it'll just click on for a little while and turn off. It clicked on and it stayed on. Like, wow, that's so odd. I wonder what's happening. I am pretty cold though. I don't know what's going on. So I move a little bit closer so I can get to where the heat's coming out. Like, man, what is happening? I turn the heat up. I'm like, all right, that's a little bit better. It's so odd. And it took me a while until I went outside. I was like, oh wow, it's really frigid. It's not, I pulled my phone, like, oh my goodness, like a total blizzard. I guess that would be another reason to pay attention to the news. You might just happen to stumble across the weather forecast and catch in advance, like, oh, we're about to have a big snowstorm. Yikes, better get avocados and things from the grocery store, which I did. Next, let's see. It is Black History Month, and one thing I've learned over the 12 years, this is a time where frequently they will release, they being whites, they will deliberately release information, be it books about Martin Luther King Jr. or Rosa Parks, you know, pick the black person. This is a good time to do it. Lots of sales, or there will be documentary films, whatever that might draw the interest of black people and or anyone in general who might want to spend some money on the subject of black people. So there's a documentary film, MLK FBI is the title of it. Sam Pollard, who did a lot of work with Spike Lee, Black Male, he's involved in the project. I have not seen the film. I just saw reports promoting the film, and then I've heard some of the interviews that he's done talking about the subject matter. And I can only say that they bring up the COINTELPRO files and Dr. King's alleged extramarital affairs. We read Coretta Scott King's autobiography, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, and she said unflinchingly, Dr. King did not have an affair. He never disclosed some sort of infidelity to her, as is portrayed dramatically in Selma and talked about in these other projects. She said that that never happened, that he was totally faithful. She never had any evidence otherwise other than the nonsense from the FBI, and that's what she recognized it as, racist nonsense. But we read that in her book, and I do not hear people quote that at all, even to bring it up to say, well, I think it's, you know, her just lying to try to cape for her deceased husband, which, you know, that could be. People do that sort of thing. I don't even hear that. People just totally ignore it and act like she didn't write a book and speak on this issue directly as someone who might have firsthand information metaphor. But I bring that up because I am of the opinion. We talked to John Patash about this some years back. He wrote the book, or one of the books, The FBI's War Against Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, and saying these FBI files and audio tapes, that's the foundation for this charge that Dr. King was some sort of sexual fiend and some sort of pervert and stepping out on Coretta Scott King. That's the basis for this charge, is these FBI files. We talked to Jason Miller, a white man, some years back, and he said he had went and talked to one of the mistresses of Dr. King and all that, and even he couldn't be direct in answering questions about what she conceded to. Like, all of that is extraordinarily suspicious. This is not trying to insist that Dr. King was perfect and never did any wrong. It's not that at all. It's just, I strongly suspect that this could be a part of the COINTELPRO agenda that was, in fact, a part of their stated agenda. Participate in killing him and messing up his work, and then make sure that we obfuscate what his work was about, obstruct there being a King holiday, which was done for years, and then we'll make sure to get this in too, to discredit his legacy, that, oh yeah, he was, you know, sexual pervert, having all these affairs and blah 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 and all the rest of it, so that that ends up being, that's what we're talking about this month, the new documentary, Dr. King's affairs and all of this stuff. I'm sure they talk about other components. Again, I haven't seen the film, but the fact that that was the lead, that consistently will be the lead, like, oh, these affairs, ooh, and they'll do that regularly. They'll come out with new files from associated with COINTELPRO, talking about these tapes and trying to get him to commit suicide. All of that should be looked at with extraordinary suspicion, in my view. We've talked about this in detail before. Let's see. Wow, we had so many metaphors. They talked about Flashpoint, Philando Castile, a black male who had a firearm and was still killed in Minneapolis, his murder being a flashpoint, and George Floyd, his murder being a flashpoint. I don't know what that means, metaphors. One of the other ones, listen to this. So this was Felipe Marquez. Now, he's one of the folks who's charged in the domestic terrorism treasonous activity at the Capitol in January on the 6th. So his, and I'm quoting from the transcript, he says, I went to on the 6th in D.C. to protest against communism and prostitution. In the middle of the Rona, he felt the need to go to Washington, D.C. to protest communism and prostitution. He continues, this is like a Rosa Parks, like Martin Luther King moment for me. I do not recall, that's a simile specifically, but I do not recall Rosa Parks, Dr. King ever storming a government building, killing police officers, encouraging the storming of federal buildings. I do not remember any of that from Rosa Parks, Dr. King, Coretta Scott King. We read her autobiography. I don't remember her talking about that either. In fact, they were accused of being communists. So I don't know, both Rosa Parks, Coretta Scott King, and Dr. King, all three of them accused of being communists. So, and Dr. King cavorting with prostitutes, you know, he's a sexual pervert and all that. So, I mean, I don't know. At minimum, it is very curious for white male and white female terrorists, traitors, to be comparing themselves to Dr. King and Rosa Parks, who I guess also were called traitors from time to time. So, yeah. Let's see. Oh, and let me, he says, Marquez, according to tour documents, is accused of not only storming the Capitol, but also breaking into the office of an Oregon senator. NPR has examined the affidavits in each case related to the Capitol riot so far, and the words of Shively and Marquez were echoed in dozens and dozens of them. Amazing. I do not remember Dr. King or Rosa Parks ever breaking into a United States senator's office to steal property or even vandalize. Maybe I missed that component of history. Let's see. Oh, and even adding one extra, if folks heard, we had a panel of young scholars on the broadcast in the middle of the week. It was phenomenal. It's one of the most enjoyable programs that we've hosted in some time. Young folks from across the U.S., and they talked about the last year and how their studies have been impacted, the school shutdowns and all of that. And within all that, one of our participants, Josephine, she's 13 years old in New York, astrophysicist in training. And she, man, had to relocate going from New York to Florida. I would have, you know, been disgruntled to, I mean, that's putting it mildly to say I would have been disgruntled. So she has to do this major relocation for school. And I said, wow, that seems like it would have been like prison. I said, oh, no. I said, well, at least it's not prison. She said, no, it was exactly like prison. And let me explain. I said, at minimum, at least if we are going to use metaphors, they should be unpacked. Let me explain. I know it may have just sound like I said a bunch of nonsense and saying that us traitors out here storming the Capitol, that we were like Rosa Parks and Dr. King. Hold on a second, Gus. Give me 5 minutes and let me explain what I mean, because it's exactly the same thing. That, okay. Don't just be throwing these metaphors out and I'm just rolling right along. Yep, Dr. King, roll up. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's what, mm-hmm. Right. Stop and explain at least, and let me see. Give me some details and let me see. Is this really like being in a prison? Oh, wow. You can't go outside. Oh, wow. Okay. They do have those armed guards down in those Florida gated communities. Anyway, for this broadcast, if we could not use similes, analogies, metaphors, if we could be direct in what we are saying, race soldiers, they are very crafty at using metaphors. Often they will compare two separate entities and insist that these are exactly alike. Rosa Parks, Dr. King, Capitol rioters. All three, same thing. Frequently, that is nonsense. Victims, myself included, we have been exposed to this sort of racist deception for a number of years. And many of us, Gus T, top of the list, metaphor, we are still learning. As such, sometimes we don't have logic or all of our ideas correctly formulated to express what we want to say. So sometimes we might have to take a little bit more time. That is totally allowed. However, sometimes what we end up doing is just substituting a metaphor, analogy, and frequently that just adds more confusion for the compensatory call-in. If we could be precise, deliberate, exact with what we are trying to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. We will be here on Monday, Tuesday. We'll be here, I believe, every day next week except Wednesday, and we might even be here Wednesday. You'll have to check and see. But we'll be here on Monday. We have a white woman, white guests only. She is in South Africa, which means we will not be on at the normal time. It'll be early in the day. So it'll be 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. White woman Kim Heller will be on the program. She wrote the book No White Lies, Black Politics and White Power in South Africa. Just came out not too long ago, at the end of last year, like literally just came out a few weeks ago. So we'll chat it up this coming Monday. I always enjoy talking to folks around the world. I think that's been a staple of the cows for a dozen years, talking about white supremacy racism as a global problem. So that'll be Monday, irregular time. Tune in early Monday, I guess in the afternoon, depending on what part of the world you're in. Always enjoy talking to white people in different parts of the world, white people, period, really. And we can check in because South Africa is an interesting location with the COVID-19. That is one of the few regions on the continent where they have had a major problem with COVID-19. And we were just talking about COVID-19 with regards to vaccines in South Africa, because it sounded a little different, at least from the clip that we listened to on the Neutralizing Workplace Racism segment. To me, it almost suggested that they would be willing to have vaccines in the workplace. We will have to talk to Ms. Heller to see what is the perspective over there. Are people protesting? Are people hesitant? Do they want the vaccine? Is it different in terms of the white population there and the black population, the non-white population, in terms of how people are thinking about the vaccine and access to it? Like, I'm very curious about all of that as well. But that is Monday. We have a different white woman on the program for Tuesday in the States. We'll be talking about the siege. But yes, white guests only, even for Black History Month, white guests only. You can take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, questions. That would be grand. Make sure everyone has at least one chance to speak. If you have additional observations or questions, just make sure everyone gets their one turn, and then you can rejoin to share again. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could please use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just make sure that we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary background noise. You can unmute, share your thoughts, kind of maybe get to a quieter area perhaps. And then once you're done, you can mute your line again. And then if you're going to rejoin us, unmute and share. Much obliged. Thank you for your cooperation. The number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Listener supported counter racist radio. Invest if you think the cows is constructive. You can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. The book review for Isabel Wilkerson's Cased, top of the page. Give it a read. They say that is the very best book of 2020. In my view, it is the second worst book ever, easily. I could be wrong, but I don't know. Oh, that's a cowbell, too. Tragic arrangements. Anyway, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. My Cash App is linked there as well. The Cash App address, cash.app/$thecows. Much obliged. Enormous thanks to all of the investors who have kept the cows broadcasting for a dozen years. I hope we have not been talking nonsense and adding to the confusion. Hopefully, we have been in some small way helping non-white people get a better understanding, more accurate understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, and what non-white people can and should be doing to solve the problem. With that, we'll get to our first few folks who dialed in *61. If you have commentary, again, be mindful about the noise. I guess I'll ask some of you all as well. I said it for workplace racism. If we have anyone at all, think over the course of your life, if you can think of a time where you voluntarily bringing a book to your workplace resulted in something constructive, somebody said something positive that was not a veiled insult, you got a raise, they got you a $5 gift card, $3 of gas, just something constructive, something worked out well, please share, because I said pretty definitively, I can't think of one incident where a black person voluntarily brought a book into a workplace setting and something good happened, even when another black person was the only individual, the only coworker, as it were, who saw the piece of literature in question. Even then, I can't think of one instance where something constructive happened where a black person in a workplace environment was showing off a book, intentionally or not. If you do have an example, though, please share. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, or the first few, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello?
Greetings, be in Toronto.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to callers and listeners as well. So I have a report here regarding the COVID-19 vaccinations. So here's the report. It was a forum that I had attended to find out more information. And it consisted of having three black doctors who were answering different questions. So what they had said was 94 to 95% effective for the vaccine, depending if it's Moderna or Pfizer. They suggested that if there are any comorbidities that are exposed to COVID-19, it increases mortality rates, in particular for persons who are diagnosed with diabetes, hypertension, or heart conditions. The doctors were suggesting to get the vaccine as soon as possible. Based in Canada, they mentioned that one in three people who contract COVID do die from the disease, and that the vaccine is does not eliminate COVID infection, but reduces its impact, making the infection less likely to yield fatal effects. They've also mentioned that those who are in or deemed high risk, such as the elderly, as well as essential workers working with the elderly and other vulnerable populations, they will have the most effective vaccination, which is the Pfizer or Moderna that requires two dosage. And then for those who are considered less at risk, they would be given the Johnson & Johnson vaccination that requires one dose, in which the efficacy rate is between 60 to 80%. Let's see. They're saying that the reason why they were encouraging people to take the vaccine is to avoid overload on the hospital system and the ICU, and also to avoid leaving doctors to choose who lives and who dies. They said that one way to find out more about the mRNA is through a Tyler Perry video that explains what it is. That's supposed to be accessed through YouTube. So if you put in mRNA Tyler Perry video in the search, it should come up. They were also mentioning that, are acknowledging that some of the healthcare workers working frontline did receive infection of the COVID because they were placed in positions where PPEs were not made available. So strong urging to ensure that the PPEs at your workplace are made available to avoid infection. They mentioned that nearly 90 million people have already taken the vaccine, and that in particular in South Africa, 10% of the black population have taken the vaccine and they've deemed it safe for now. They were also mentioning that the virus does tend to mutate as it's smart, multiplies, and wants to live. However, I did ask a question regarding animal to human transmission, because most of the focus has been on human to human transmission. So for the animal to human transmission, in particular with dogs, I was asking the questions as to what types of methods are going to be implemented to prevent that type of transmission, as there are a lot of people, in particular white people, walking dogs and having them up close to others who do not give consent to having them. Also, that's about it. So that's so far what I've gathered from the information of the forum. But as soon as I find out further information, I'll definitely share. Thanks so much, and I leave the line.
Much obliged. Be in Toronto. I did track the Tyler Perry video where he's discussing the COVID-19 vaccine and alleged hesitancy by black people. Victims guarantee qualified. I certainly don't have, there is no problem with Mr. Perry sharing his views on the vaccine or anything else, really. But given the products that I've seen from Mr. Perry, I'm not sure that he would sway my views on the Rona situation either way. Like, he's not someone I would view as a reputable source for health-related information. I don't think Tyler Perry is not a medical doctor. He might be. I know he's made a lot of films, made lots of money from making films, but I don't think he's a qualified medical professional. So, yeah, that would, if anything, for me, that would be 2 weeks in a row. I think last week they said we should get the National Guard to hand out Rona vaccines. E. Reddit Ohio brought that up. That does not make me feel better. And then, yes, VGQ, he might have great information. Maybe I should check it out. In fact, that might be best to check. But again, it's like, man, that's what I would be thinking. Like, man, I don't normally think of going to check out Tyler Perry for constructive information. Certainly not health-related information. But, Much obliged. Thanks for sharing. Be in Toronto. If anyone has seen the Tyler Perry video and, if you thought he had constructive information, was helpful or what have you, please share. Gus could be, totally wrong. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Bay Area mom. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I saw the Tyler Perry video as he was he already pre-announced that he would do it, because I guess they came to Tyler Perry and asked him, because they're trying to convince us to take this shot, the vaccine or whatever. And he said he would if he could record it. And because I'm sure somebody makes some money. So there was this I think she was a nurse who's the one speaking. So he's asking her the question. And it was like, well, out of one of the 70s exploitation movies, the way she's explaining, she's using a lot of metaphors to explain what the messenger RNA shot does to get it into your body and fight the virus. And, it's just like, when you're on the streets. And it was awful the way she was describing it. Her arm. You need to watch it, because it's ridiculous. So, oh dear. Yeah, it was awful. But I guess as far as entertainment, we like that kind of entertainment. So if someone's going to participate in receiving this experimental biological agent because of the way it was presented and Tyler Perry was involved, for one. And I'd like to say something about the clip that you did in East Oakland about the water rising and the pollutants in the air. In West Oakland, McClyman's had to shut down. There's a high school called McClyman. It had to shut down because of that issue, and it had been going on for years, and no one did anything about it until 2019, and that's when they decided to close the school down for that reason. But who knew how long it had been happening, and they said it was a problem before, but not enough to close the school down. And I'll mute my line, and thanks for taking my call.
Much obliged for sharing environmental racism. That's something that I would not have even considered, the rising sea levels. That's being another contributor to environmental racism in terms of pushing contamination up from beneath the earth. Like, I would not have considered that. But why? And then they immediately got to, oh, yes, the Negroes in East Oakland. Yes, they are definitely going to be impacted by this. Like, Of course. No surprise there at all. Like, I have not seen the Tyler Perry video. I have to check it out. VGQ, I don't have anything, you know, bad to say about him. And he may have had totally correct intentions. It's just for me, I'm not sure if Tyler Perry would persuade me about anything. Just be like, oh, okay, that's, he's talking about anything, yoga, vegan eating, like, I'm not sure, but certainly, like, health related, like, serious health related matters, like, how much sway should I give to Tyler Perry? And it would be the same if they said, you know, we got Julia Roberts or Tom Hanks, you know, any other entertainer, like, wait a minute, like, that's great, I like Forrest Gump and all, they're not medical professionals. Like, if it's time to talk serious, like, you have people to come and talk serious about serious matters, right? Yes. Even him being the pitch person, right? She said he was asking questions and everything and then using lots of metaphors. Somebody does have that program once a week where they say no metaphors. Let's be precise, particularly if it's time, you know, we want exact information. I do not want a lot of metaphors, and especially if it's going to be metaphors that are questionable, making me feel like you're talking to me like I'm in a Shaft movie and we're supposed to be talking about seriously about a vaccine that I might have questions or hesitancy about. Eesh. Other people who dialed in with a hand up, I guess if we have any other folks, because I might be, what they call it, Johnny Come Lately, where I'm the only one who did not see the Tyler Perry video where he discussed these matters. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. I saw as much of it as I could stand. It kind of like characterize non-white black people of only able to respond to something that sounded kind of silly about a serious subject. That appears to me on how it was characterized, and like I said, I listened to as much of it as I can stand. Somebody sent it to me, that otherwise I wouldn't have been looking for it. That's all. I can only stand about maybe about 30-40 seconds of it, and also as a report, books. Not really accepting it as a challenge, but in the workplace that I was on, it was somewhat different from most other workplaces, being that you, you know, stay in a house-like arrangement and you're there for 24 hours. And reading books and magazines is very much encouraged. They're all over the place at a fire station. And I'm not talking about just books on the fire department either. Back during the time when I was working, it would have everything from Rated X to, you know, the Bible in itself. But it was kind of personable as far as my experiences. And if you did share it with somebody, if I did share it with somebody, it was more than likely somebody that I spent time with off duty, doing things in the areas where non-white black people were at. And you basically just similar on what we do on, Kyle's participants do on, Thursdays. It's, you know, kind of like that, that was going on at the time. DCS program, is coming near the end. Today, because Mr. Clark mentioned about that there was, if it wasn't for COVID-19, that we probably would have went on a field trip to see that, I believe there's some sort of movie or something on Fred Hampton. I'm not a, I think I heard a little bit about it. But anyway, being that he mentioned that, I decided to today to show the Eyes on the Prize segment on Chairman Fred Hampton, Black Panther Party Chairman Fred Hampton out of Chicago. And it went well as far as the young people paying attention to the 25-minute segment. And there was a question and answer period and comment period that went well. And that's basically it that I have to report. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. And certainly that is a unique situation both ways. If you're in a work environment where you're actually going to be sleeping or bunking on the job, and then also if you actually know these folks really, really well, and you know, you have a rapport, the job rapport, like that's probably not going to be the case with too many people in their work environment. So yeah, that's that right there shows you the rarity of it all. I haven't seen it, but that I've not seen it. Reading more important than watching television, but I think it's Judas and the Black Messiah, I think, is the film. I do not intend on seeing it. I think this is another one, and I'm not interested in hearing maybe the last 5 minutes because we don't do entertainment or Area 8. But I will say I think this is another one, or it's not even I think this is another one, just like Selma, where they do a biopic that's based on the life and most of the time the death assassination of a black person. And they get a black person who is not born in the U.S. to play the main role. It is here again. We do not get a black person born in the U.S. to be Fred Hampton. But again, even if they had, I still probably wouldn't watch this film. These type of films generally are not done accurately. You would be much better served to go and read about these people or watch Eyes on the Prize. There are tons of documentaries about these people than watching some sort of filtered, probably deceptive dramatization of these people's lives. But maybe last 5 minutes if folks have anything to add on that. Other folks that we have missed totally, number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-POUND. pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate.
Greetings, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings, Gus, greetings, listeners and callers. I also want to share what I believe to be a constructive outcome in regards to displaying a book in the workplace. I was able to recommend and then later gift a fellow victim with a copy of An Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison. I was also able to recommend Tommy Curry's The Man Nut. I have a question, if anybody would like to chime in on this. I don't know if I missed part of the earlier broadcast, but I've been fascinated with the proceedings of the second impeachment of Donald Trump. So I want to ask you, do you think it would be accurate to describe the second Trump impeachment proceedings in contrast to the trials of the murderers of Emmett Till? The reason I ask this is because I think it provides a lesson how white supremacy operates and perpetuated. Because it appears to me that the evidence was overwhelming to the guilt of the white terrorists, but they still would be acquitted. And Gus, will you mute my line? Thanks.
Much obliged. Let's see, Invisible Man and The Man Knot. We read both of those in the book club. Excellent. Top 10, both of those choices. Whew. Hopefully, good rapport with the folks that you shared it with. That can be a risky endeavor in the workplace. With the question, and I guess other folks can respond to this as we proceed, the impeachment proceedings against President Trump, which are done, they did not find him guilty, which I did not expect that they would. The Senate two times around not found guilty. In terms of comparing, contrasting these proceedings to the murder trial of Emmett Till, I'm not a scholar in jurisprudence. That being said, I hadn't compared the two, and I have not been particularly fascinated with the impeachment proceedings this time around because I suspected that he was not going to be found guilty. So I didn't feel it required a great deal of investigation. I don't think they're going to seriously, to the fullest extent of the law, prosecute all of the white perpetrators who stormed the Capitol. So we'll have to see. I'm slightly more interested in all of those proceedings. But my initial thought would be there's some glaring differences. I mean, it's a murder trial as opposed to a presidential impeachment trial, not to mention different errors. But I mean, a trial by a jury of civilians as opposed to a trial where it's senators, United States senators, like some major differences, I guess, to the point about there being evidence, clear evidence to convict. Substantially different just because we're talking a double murder, even though people did die in the siege, but he wasn't being charged with murder, as opposed to a double murder where there's clear evidence and clear evidence that he fomented a siege. There are quite a few differences, I would just say, quite a few differences. But in terms of evidence to convict, I think they probably had that both times Mr. Trump was impeached. Let's see, but other folks, if they want to respond, comparing the Emmett Till murder trial to the impeachment proceedings against former President Trump, you can add that to your response as we proceed. Number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate.
Can I be heard?
Rob in California. Yes, sir.
Greetings, callers and listeners. That's the host. I hope everybody is doing as well as can be expected this evening.
just getting back from the plantation. Initially, I was supposed to go in Sunday. I do go in tomorrow as well, but I was called in today. No problem. We're going to make extra money or more money. So went in today. Now, it was only about maybe 55 to 60 degrees today for a high in San Diego. And it was very, very busy today. People were really coming out to dine outside, kind of surprising to me. I don't feel like I was terrorized today. People were pretty busy, so it wasn't a lot of time for not being efficient with your task at hand on the job. But what I did observe is that I am one of the oldest employees there. It's a couple people older than me, but in the area that I work in, it's around the average age of about 25, and that's being generous. And so what I noticed today is that even in the midst of it being very busy, even with it being very busy, the younger employees are not as efficient at doing their job, and they don't seem to care to be. It's more of a party atmosphere, and everyone kind of hangs out socially outside of work. So when they come to work, it's more, a lot more socializing than focusing on the task at hand. And of course, that falls on me. And another thing that I observed, like, I try to be as efficient as I can with my job, and it has been working out. And what I noticed is that when people see me staying focused on my task and being efficient, they try and overcompensate. You know, like, I see them trying to follow my lead. No, let me say that. I see them trying to work as efficiently as I am. But I'm busy right now. But it ends up being chaotic more than efficient. And so the last observation about work is that even though I can see people noticing me being efficient on the job, my hours don't reflect my efficiency. And I wanted to share as well, when I called into the program today, I tried both numbers, same experience, the 1 cent per minute thing. So the interference continues. And so I wanted to address the question, but I'm a little confused as far as what were you asking again, if you don't mind repeating that stuff?
Let's see. I'll repeat it, and then the caller who asked the question, he can let me know if I botched it or if I got it correct. I believe his question was the Emmett Till murder trial in Mississippi. Would that compare to the impeachment proceedings against former President Trump, in that there was lots of evidence to convict Emmett Till's murderers, just like there was lots of evidence to convict Trump? And in both cases, there was an acquittal. And he was saying, wouldn't those cases compare? I believe that was the question. He can let me know if I got it correct or not.
Okay. I would have to think about that. I don't have an answer to that question right now, but it is a very interesting question. And I'll mute my line for now and then chime back in if I have a chance to later. Thank you for listening. Thank you for.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Did we get the question correct? Just want to make sure I didn't mess it up. My hearing might be bad. Did we get your question correct, sir?
No, I think that's a most efficient way to ask the question. Yes, thank you.
For sure, for sure. Try to be accurate. I said that for a while too. Strive for accuracy. 720-716-7300. The code 564-943#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other
Hello.
Folks, Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Salutations, Gus, and salutations to everyone on the line. Okay, so had some notes from your headlines. Okay, so the gentleman said Jasmine Sullivan couldn't do any wrong, and she's correct. She's a victim of racism, and that's why they showcased her during the Super Bowl. And I love her voice, and I love her songwriting, but her last album is loaded with, or that's a metaphor, I suppose, but it's a lot about sexual misconduct between black men and women, incorrect behavior. And then I found The Weeknd to be an interesting choice because he comes across aloof to me. I would even say I suspect he's homosexual or bisexual. And one of his songs that made me stop listening to him, he has lyrics where he says, "I can't feel my face when I'm with you." And I decodified that as drug use, cocaine use, from finding out that someone I know used cocaine and described that as an effect. So, yeah, there's that. About the soil excerpt, to me it's more evidence that white supremacists are divested from living on planet Earth permanently, because if they were, they would prevent or correct ecological problems if they plan to stay here and thrive. And it's evidence to me of what Dr. King said about rugged individualism, but it's on every level of existence, you know, literally down to the soil. Someone said that people were racist against Asians. I think that's dishonest. She could have just said racist. People that are racist. But nope, that wasn't going to happen. And let's see, an infatuation for incarceration. Absolutely, yes. And I suspect the bank will find another way to invest in these companies, because if a companies can own companies. So you can invest in a company without investing in that specific company. You can invest in a subsidiary. You can invest in the stock. Because if they got a promise to just not give loans, it doesn't mean they're going to change how they leverage other money necessarily on the stock market or whatever so-called instruments that they come up with for banking. And these companies affect the stock market and economics, commercial economics, too much for them to honestly say that they'll completely divest, because white supremacy depends on enslaved or incarcerated people to do free work under the conditions of abuse and or, you know, mistreatment, just like you said. And I had a report of medical apartheid as well. So my son wasn't feeling well, and I had reported that, and he was hospitalized. And I specifically put on his paperwork that they cannot change, add, subtract, up or lower a dose of any medication whatsoever without my explicit permission. And it was good, because if not, my son probably would have been given a psychotropic that would have changed the way his mind worked completely. forever. And she, the doctor was intimidated, I believe, by me because I use 24-hour format when I tell the time instead of AM and PM. And she was like, well, were you in the military? I said, yes. And I didn't tell her what branch or nothing. It didn't matter. And then I was in the midst of trying to organize some papers while she was speaking to me. And she was like, what's that noise? So I was like, I'm multitasking. I'm listening to you and I'm doing some other stuff. You continue. There's nothing stopping you. So then a day later, she called and said, well, has your son been on mood stabilizers? And I said, no. I said, what are you proposing? I just wanted to know. And she said, well, I'm thinking he should be on lithium and one other drug, but I hadn't heard. I can't remember right now. And I was like, lithium? Oh, you called the right person. You got the right parent today. So I just told her simply, no, absolutely not. You can't give my son anything that he hasn't been given before. Like I said, that what he got is before is what he's going to get until he gets out and we figure something else out. Well, I didn't tell her that, but, you know, that's basically it. Just stay on the format we have already for this one particular medical plan that's already in place. And when I told my partner about it, he was like, you know, I said, well, I used a metaphor with my son, and I was like, if your condition right now is like having a broken window in your house, then receiving lithium would be like burning the house down. And then my partner said, no, it would be like when they burned down the library in Alexandria. And I found that to be fascinating and to me correct, because he's a young man and she knows he has vigor and she knows he has knowledge and ability. And to try to permanently disable him like that, I've seen what lithium can do to people from documentaries. And when I used to work in mental health, I've seen people on lithium and it never helped them. They stayed psychotic. So I'm just glad God is good. You know, and Gus, you know, the prayer that you said at the end, you know, I thank you for that, because I do pray it frequently, and I do. I just pray and ask the Creator to end it whenever possible, as soon as possible. I don't understand why this is happening, but I'm still learning, and I just pray for everybody's health and safety. Oh, one other thing about Fred Hampton, a friend of mine that lives in Chicago, lives right next to where Fred Hampton was murdered. And what the city of Chicago did was basically level the house, and they have not replaced that empty lot with anything. There isn't even a marker. And for a couple of years, I was going over by a house, and she was like, you know, Fred Hampton died right there. I said, where? She said, right there in that empty lot. That's where the house was. I was like, I was astounded. So at the time, I was studying Yoruba, and I went and gave some libations and put some coins down for him, and I just blessed his name. But yeah, that's how much they think about Fred Hampton, but now they want to make a movie out of it, whatever. The commercialization of the death of Black people. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Worth more once you're dead. Absolutely. Much obliged. I am super sorry to hear about your son. You had told us before him dealing with some medical issues. Like, man, that is always the coon man, medical apartheid. Like, that is always like an abysmal experience, having to navigate that either for yourself or for an attempted family member. And it's, as we talked about that, having that person there to advocate for you, how important that, because they will do anything, try to slip any old drug or experimental procedure or anything, and just having someone who can be there to advocate for you, like, bravo. Vernelia Randall, that's one of the more important lessons of many she shared when she was with us the first time way back in 2009. She was just here last year talking about the Rona too, but make sure if you are not feeling well, have someone who is relatively healthy there to advocate and just ask questions like, man, does it have to be this severe? What are the side effects? Those types of questions. You don't have to have a PhD in biology or anything else. You don't have to be a doctor. Just ask questions. And she said the same thing. They accused Dr. Susan Moore. That was the black physician. She contracted COVID-19. That's what they reported. And she did a video saying she was experiencing racism from the medical staff. And then she ended up passing away. And then after she died, they said, oh, man, she was intimidating. You know, she frightened us, you know, scary, scowling COVID-19 positive niggers. You know, they're dangerous. Yeah, yeah. Much obliged and job well done, Irie, advocating for your child. The Super Bowl was just tacky. Not that that's super important, but she did mention we had the beginning clip on that. The Super Bowl was rife with so much tackiness. They just had the Kansas City assistant coach run over this non-white child, two cars, her whole family, basically. They just had that. And then they come with the tacky Super Bowl and they have tacky ad after tacky ad. I played the it was an Eminem commercial at the beginning where it was like a social justice themed Eminem commercial where they had the white man come out at the beginning. He's talking to a white woman and he says, I'm so sorry for, you know, taking over and mansplaining and blah, blah, blah. And then I think they have a white woman who goes up to a white woman and says, I'm so sorry I called you a Karen. She says, my name is Karen. I'm so sorry your name is Karen. And it's all these like kind of social justice themed jokes in the Eminem commercial. And then they didn't just have the black female, I forget her name, my apologies, who did the poem at President Biden's inauguration. She was there. Never heard a poem before a Super Bowl. I mean, brain damage, poetry, what? But then they had a black person, Jasmine Sullivan. She did the national anthem, which they're supposed to get rid of. And then they had a black person doing the sign language for the national anthem. It's like, wow, like they are really going extra. But I mean, it was just black people. They had black National Guards members. And I thought they were going to like roll Colin Kaepernick out and be like, we're making him the honorary commissioner for the day. Black people are in charge. I mean, they could have made Andrew Gillum honorary governor of Florida for the day. Like, it totally looked like black people are in charge of the Super Bowl. Black people run the state of Florida. They could have wheeled retired firefighter out. We're going to make him honorary mayor of Miami for the day. Whoopee. Black people are in charge of the sunshine. I mean, it was over the top. Well, I won't say it was intense racial showcasing, and we are just going to make it look, we are going to pretend really, really good that we are all about ending racism. And they even had that. In fact, they had that written on some of the helmets and NFL paraphernalia, end racism. Like it was a staggering display, to say the least. Other folks that we have missed, totally. If you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I peeped the sign language guy. I was like, I never saw someone do sign language for the national anthem before, which was very interesting. Tyler Perry, I saw a medical professional, black female. She was talking down to black people in a very stereotypical way, like we're ignorant and uneducated, unable to understand English the way we were taught it in school. She talked down to us, and in one word, I would say satire. It reminded me of the booty to the pole video, sort of like that. Unfortunately, there was a big story this week, a 40-year-old black female with 5 children posting a video on TikTok, put Gorilla Glue in her hair, and after days of trauma, because what I thought about immediately was Dr. Welsing, her talking point, if she had a pill to sell black women, you know, that they could get the hair they desired, you know, like, wow. And also, a commentary about Taraji P. Henson playing dressed up in the gorilla outfit on Empire. Just, you know, seeing this black girl, and every time you see her, they got the gorilla glue bottle next to her face. It's just, you know, the Super Bowl halftime show. They let The Weeknd sing a song about getting high on cocaine. I said, wow, I can't feel my face when I'm like, ooh. The clip from The Root that you played, I think the perspective that many blacks have that Republicans are racist, therefore Democrats are not, is very dangerous, especially when you look at the policies that affect black people, to which more than 50% were written by the Democrats. So the area of white supremacy is number six, politics. Both sides are racist. Trump defeated another unlawful impeachment. The first impeachment, unprecedented, they held secret trial in the Capitol basement with no Republicans, no cross-examinations, took away his ability to face his accusers if they existed. This time, they didn't even have a judge. It's like, come on. Democrats play edited audio tapes, doctored videos, totally Photoshopped, and Trump's lawyer just played the original to debunk the case. My question is this happening to black people in courts around the United States? It looks so real until the next day. In the state of Florida, around the Super Bowl, someone hacked into the computer system that operates their water supply and attempted to add a deadly concentration of sodium hydroxide to their water. One of the chemicals that they use to purify the water if they put it in a small amount. Then we found out they got hacked because they're using Windows 7 on the computer that operates the water system. I'm like, my goodness, I mean, Windows 7 replaced it Windows Vista in like 2009. Like, man, every company I work for, white people, where I tell you, they upgrade their system as soon as the new one comes out, IT is at your desk installing it. I just don't understand why the state governments aren't doing the same. Alabama prisons at 160% capacity. Two words for that, Joe Biden. Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994. State of Alabama has 25% black citizens. Over 50% of the people in prison are black. Once again, Joe Biden, the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986. His upgraded one in 1988. That's the mandatory minimum. The Crime Control Act of 1990, your deadbeat dads and your gun-free zones. I mean, just tacking on how much time they can give black people. And now they're at capacity. Lastly, Domestic Terrorism Task Force. The worst idea I could think of. Black people who support this. Man, the only people that's been designated as domestic terrorists are black identity extremists. I haven't seen anyone else get designated in that capacity. We could be designated that for listening to the cows. And what, they'll have a task force that could tap our phones and follow us around and harass us? It just, I mute my mind. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Why not Bill Clinton? If we're going to pick two words, Bill, would that suffice? We're going to pick two words for that. Would Bill Clinton work too instead of Joe Biden?
Oh, for sure. It was Bill Clinton's. It's called the Bill Clinton Crime Bill, but Joe Biden voted. That's why I said Joe Biden.
Either or. Either or. Same party. The party of racist man, racist woman, and racist child. Incidentally, we did have a report. I believe it was last week. My memory could be incorrect, but I'm sure it was Black History Month, where they said white people might do a lot of talking about holding people accountable. President Trump acquitted today. They might do a lot of talk about holding a lot of the treasonous white terrorists accountable. If they do anything, Department of Homeland Security, FBI, J. Edgar Hoover Building, Justice Department, if they do anything, they say, ooh, we're going to get serious. Crack down on social media and extremists. It will be the Al Sharptons and Gus T. Renegades, those will be the people that they come after, not Kyle Rittenhouse. For sure. Or Timothy McVeigh. Long-running problem. Let's see. Other folks that we missed totally. If you have a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start out with the segment where they were speaking about how, I guess, the majority of the people that breached the Capitol, I guess they tried to mention gender and say it was mainly men. They didn't even say white men. And it looks like they were trying to say that they felt like they weren't getting what they deserve or something like that. Or if they worked hard, they would be able to do what their grandfathers did or whatever. And they didn't even really explain what that means. Because, of course, you know, there were women, white women in that crowd as well. But the way that they use the term domestic terrorism, they don't apply white to the title, really. They barely like saying white supremacy. They'll say domestic terrorism, and we don't have any task force in certain, I think that's what they were saying, in certain organizations that are dedicated to domestic terrorism. So, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised at that. If we're in a system of white supremacy and white people themselves are in those positions, they wouldn't want to have the focus on themselves. And then they use, I guess, the term radical Islam or something of that nature. See, they apply the either label of the group of non-white people when it comes to terrorism, but for themselves is something vague, domestic terrorism. So I noticed that. And I noticed they keep using the term race to vaccinate. I'm like, why should it be a race to vaccinate? Competition or, you know, what exactly? And black people are the hardest hit, certain words being used in certain ways, and nothing gets attributed to white defiance. Two more things. The segment about the football player, Chad, I think is what his name is. That was interesting that he is quoted as saying, bow to me or something like that. Definitely white supremacy in that, in my opinion. For him to just, from her testimony, I guess, he just comes up to her just saying, just bow to me. And she's like, no, and then he goes into violent rage. And as you mentioned before, like, oh, you're still alive? Just that kind of pathology definitely should be studied by victims of racism. And I'm wondering, it didn't seem like, well, not to me, it didn't seem like it got displayed in what's called the media as much as it was with Ray Rice, if people remember, the black male. And this seemed like definitely it was way more of a vicious act, but all across definitely is violence in general shouldn't be occurring. So I don't know what the punishment is going to be for him. And my last one is there was the sheriff's department, very tacky. A race soldier put out a video. It was on our local news, and he's sitting in a first person view, or what would be a first or second person view, in front of the camera. And this is connecting with Valentine's Day, so-called Valentine's Day. And someone brings him a drink, and it looks like he's sitting in a restaurant setting. And he's talking about warrants or something like that. And he's appealing to females who have ex-boyfriends. And he's saying, well, if you were thinking about your ex-boyfriend and you've seen his mugshot, just give us a call to the Marion County Sheriff's Office. And, you know, we have these nice, lovely, heart-shaped handcuffs for them. And they will spend the night in the local jail. And you can receive a cash reward. And you can remain anonymous. And you can just go spend the money on whatever you want. Thank you. Have a nice day. I mean, super. I think racism is in that as well. But they are crafty with the language. And that's all I want to report. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged. Does not get any better than tacky, for sure. I thought that was important, too, that they did not mention white men, just saying it was men, as opposed to white men. Wasn't Al Sharpton down taking over the Capitol building? And I'm in Seattle, so I thought the Wheeler thing, at least locally, like I said, it was a big deal here. Nationally, I'm not sure, but I definitely thought, like, now the Ray Rice. Now, certainly with the Ray Rice, they actually had video eventually, so you could actually see what happened on the elevator first time, last time. They don't have the video of it, but I mean, wow, just her face alone is, they say, what does they say? A picture is 1,000 words. Like, yeah. More than enough. I'm not sure how much attention, if this is, you know, the Ray Rice situation was huge, and that was 2014. It was the summer of 2014. I was of the opinion that that became a big deal. They released the video footage of Ray Rice abusing his, I think they were not married at the time, they are now, abusing his partner. And I said, well, you had this video. I think they had that video in like February of 2014. They don't release it until like September, which just happens to be right in the middle of Ferguson protest, Eric Garner, that was in July 2014, and Black Lives Matter and all the protests and everything every day that went on for months. In the middle of that, now is the time that we, oh my goodness, look at this Ray Rice. You sure you want to go out there and cape for these black males? Think about it. Could be another Ray Rice. Michael Brown Jr., he was strong arm robbery. Another Ray Rice in the waiting. That was my feeling. It's in the archives, but that was my feeling at the time. But yeah, I'm not sure how much attention, or at least compare, is this going to get the same amount of focus and outrage as the Ray Rice situation? We shall see. Any folks that we missed totally, anyone who had a hand up commentary to share that we'd have missed completely?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is a irritated caller, Kyle's listener from the Midwest, freezing. Yeah, like I said before, you know, the cows, it's, definitely, changed things for me. I used to be able to forget, get lulled to sleep by people's talking. Now I'm breaking down everybody's sentence, white or black, that speaks to me. I'm fragmenting down all speech and in my head on the spot, trying to break it down. So it's a everyday thing now since 2014 for me. I started making decisions based off of that alone, Mr. Fuller, teachings. But, to the caller about the, you know, I'm sitting here while the college was on watching, you know, them acquit, the former president and, you know, the only comparison I understand what the caller was saying about them, but the only comparison I can see is white people, white law will protect white people. That's the only comparison there. And they can fudge and switch. When I say fudge, meaning they can, on the spot, change the law while applied. They can just, any way they want to do, diddle with the law. And the black people that are appointed cannot, the non-white people that are appointed cannot say anything. They can't challenge it at all. They, it's obvious, like Gus was talking about earlier, with the games and stuff, the tackiness of just racial showcasing, of this era we live in now. I always remember when the basketball finally came back in the bubble, you were like, the players were having, why don't you love us or love us or, just super like, you were like, yuck. And I always remember that when I see that, like, super tacky. So I wanted to talk about, a couple things I want to talk about, not to relegate to sports, but, I do keep my eye on it. So, usually in the morning I'll listen to Undisputed with Shannon Sharpe and Skip, and they're talking about the Pledge of Allegiance that Mark Cuban, the owner, stops. He said he wasn't going to play it anymore, and all the white people got outraged and called the commissioner. He commanded that they play it. Mark Cuban was trying to defuse a problem, I guess. But I remember Skip and Shannon going back and forth, and Skip tells Shannon, hey, by doing that, it feels like the fall of Rome. Rome is falling. When he said that, I started thinking, like, Rome is falling. Shannon's retort was, well, hell, Rome was falling on the 6th of January. That's what I thought. And right there, to me, it's like, Skip was basically saying white supremacy is going to fall. And I'm scared of that. That's a sign that Rome's going to fall. I don't want that. And instead of addressing the problem right there, you got to talk around it. We're not going to solve this problem if we're constantly talking around things. We don't talk about certain areas of activity. We stay away from those activities. But those activities are the big things that I feel, my opinion, VGQ, that keep us, not exploring all nine areas and really in depth. And, we talk about the areas that affect us that we can talk about, but I just feel like you said, I remember a couple of weeks ago, this code, I feel like, needs to be refined. It needs to be refined even more. The white supremacists and how their ideology has been refined, I know in the code book it says stay away from the four wallism. I think that needs to be revisited. I think that needs to be developed. It needs to be a four-wallism. It needs to be where people are being taught on 12 o'clock noon Times Square. The code needs to be blasted up front. Like, it just feels like it's only a small half a percent of people on the planet that even know about the word, the code. White people stay on code all across the planet, So, I don't know. Sorry for the gripe. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, sir. I think there have been many, 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 many attempts at the four-wallism. Certainly, victims guaranteed qualified, but I think what might even be said that Fred Hampton's organization might be one such illustration that attempt has been tried, and I think folks can do a lot of studying, not discouraging anyone if they want to go out and attempt and think they have some modifications to make it more successful. Get out there and do it and report back the results. But at least I would study, why has it been such a problem in terms of non-white people erecting a building to say this is going to be a place where we go to study and strategize how to end racism? It seems that there have been lots of problems. Even Dr. Welsing, the Welsing Institute, difficulty in getting a specific location to do this on a regular basis. Dr. Welsing had lots of problems for years trying to just, and that was just once a week, or excuse me, once a month, just once a month on a so-called black campus. And it was very difficult in the archives where she even explains. But again, get out and do it. If anything, I'm just saying all this so that folks know, like, the challenge will be, you know, pretty substantial in terms of having a location. But get out and do it. Just research, figure out some of those pitfalls that many black people have experienced and make the appropriate adjustments. That is indeed what codification is about. With that, we will wrap things up. We will be here on Monday. Kim Heller, white woman, South Africa, irregular time. It'll be 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. Always enjoy speaking to folks in different parts of the world, white people regardless. So right there, tune in unless you're, you know, occupied in the middle of your Monday afternoon. And then we'll be here again Tuesday, regular time. We'll have another white woman talking about the siege, maybe the impeachment, all of the role of white women in all of this. But that'll be on Tuesday. Stay tuned for the other broadcast for throughout the rest of the week. Much obliged to everyone for participating. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Super appreciate hearing people saying they are paying close attention to what people say around them, white people and victims of racism, and people looking to refine their code. That is certainly something we should all be working on. And just being, hey, there are, it should seem like there aren't a whole lot of non-white people who are working on codification. That is how successful white people, racist man, racist woman, racist child, that is how successful they are. You don't have very many. So if anything, that should just be more of the motivation and how daunting this task is going to be. Not saying that to discourage anyone, just being truthful, promise no easy victories. Whew. Our foe is substantial. All of that said, we will be back Monday. Sobriety would be best. Britt Reed. Lots of reasons. Sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, I would say, well, hey, we now have about, I think, a half a foot of snow on the ground. So easy for me to say hunker down. For people in Florida and California, I would say, hey, it seems like there's still lots of rowdy white people out and about and then wrangling over masks and all the rest of it. I would be very alert if you are going out, if you see any white people being loud, hostile, time to exit. It is not a good time for confronting verbal hostilities with strangers, white or non-white, in public space. You should be thinking this person could be armed. This person may have been at the siege, and this person may have a whole militia with them who are also armed and ready to do harm. If you don't have a militia yourself, if you didn't leave with a plan to engage in mortal combat, let's get out of here. Be very mindful of that. And I would say share with folks that you care about. Very dangerous times, especially in the U.S. where you have lots of folks who are armed. With that, if you're going out, you're sober, you're buckled. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. Just doing the small things that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. Again, being alert, be mindful of what's happening around you. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times. in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.